Hear me, leaders of the tribes of Pellucidar. These changes came to our world. A world ruled by the Mehars who have enslaved and tortured us. For as long as we can recall, our tribes have been divided. Now, with the help of our newfound friends, we are united. And we have the strength and the power to destroy once and for all those who have enslaved us. Death to the Mehars!
You cannot mesmerize me! I'm British!
It's Friday. It's 2 minutes past five. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 27th of October, 2023. Streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. And live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, but please don't download it from Google. Download it from the App Store, which you can get on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, where there's all sorts of other apps there that you can't get on the Google Play Store because Google doesn't like them, like the Rumble app and the Telegram app, which Google changed before it was allowed them to go on there. So if you want to get the original, gold-plated, go to our little app store at thisweek.org.uk. It's not actually ours. It's just a link to an alternative one. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade propaganda psyops, puff pieces on the conspirators and on the mass murderers and on the genocidalists, and hatchet jobs on the heroes, cancelling vote winners like Boris and Trump, whilst big farmers Matt Hancock and Bill Gates, crimes against humanity, and of course Mr. Netanyahu's are all supposedly they're all sidelined. Actually, now the evil Putin and the evil Hamas are the only thing we're supposed to be thinking about. So anyway, helping us navigate through the Fourth Reich Matrix, or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also joining me in the studio is he's just finished working for PCS now, Justin Thomas. Hi, Justin.
Hi there, thanks, Tony.
So that's it. You're off to Pastors Newer. And PCS, if people don't know, represents how many civil servants?
200,000 ballpark.
Of which I think 90,000 Jacob Rees-Mogg wanted to get rid of.
How did
he get on with that little project?
Well, that project went away, but now it's come back again in another guise. So they're still trying to push this, go back to civil service numbers before Brexit.
Is that correct, that there 90,000 extra civil servants were employed during Brexit?
I don't think it was quite as many as 90,000, and it wasn't all down to Brexit. I mean, obviously, you know, the population gets bigger, you hope the economy gets bigger, but certainly there was things that were done in Europe that had to be done in this country, and that meant employing more civil servants.
Okay, so yeah, of course, it's obvious, isn't it? If you're going to be taking on some of these European responsibilities, you're going to need to employ more people. And of course, this was anathema to most Tories, the idea that you're going to massively expand the civil service, but they had to do it because of Brexit.
Yeah, for example, you know, just this idea of running around the world getting trade deals with everybody, well, you needed someone to do it. And when we were in the EU, that was done by people in Brussels, so clearly we had to do it, and we also had to do it with the EU. So, yeah, there was just a couple of strands of work that came their way.
So you're off to Prospect now. This is one of these bigger unions that various other unions have merged into. Which unions?
I mean, certainly the latest was Bec2. I mean, Prospect's been around
Bec2,
for a while. Bec2,
for those that don't know, is the broadcast technicians union. For quite a lot of us working in broadcasting, it was a toss-up between whether to join the NUJ or Bec2, depending on most people could join either. A lot of people could join either anyway, not necessarily the sort of technical staff, but The Beck 2 magazine was excellent. It was a really good magazine. I always remember looking at passing around one of them back, I think it was about 2008, 2009. Horrific front cover where the Israeli army had come into one of the Palestinian areas. Not only had they destroyed their most of their radio station or their television station, they got pornographic videos and they were just broadcasting them right across that whole part of the country, loads of hardcore porn videos. So this was their, and it was, as far as I know, the Beck 2 magazine was one of the only places in the country where this got reported. But this is a pretty horrific tactic of the Israeli army at the time. And so I was sort of thinking, well, maybe I should join Beck 2. But anyway, so what other unions?
I can't tell you, Tony, I'm afraid. Sorry, they've been prospects as long as I've known them.
Okay,
and
right,
Beck 2 was the latest, you know.
Okay, so, reason I've asked you to come in was because we were just chit-chatting on Facebook, weren't we?
Yeah,
this is a bit sad, isn't it, really? A couple of bored people, but we weren't actually that bored, but talking about veganism. And I know that you are a vegan. So before we chat to you and I interrogate you about this, topic, Martin, what about this whole prospect of you did this PPE subject. I don't know if you covered this, but I'm sure you'll have something to say about it as to whether humans are naturally meat eaters or not.
Well, I think there's not much debate about this. We are omnivores. We're capable of eating all sorts of different things. It's one of the reasons why we're so successful, and we breed like cockroaches. But
well, you don't.
Well, some of us do.
Well, that's the sort of thing the Israelis might say about the Palestinians.
Well,
it's a very,
right,
very
well,
nasty comment.
That's a misanthropic remark.
Yes, okay.
But I think it's quite clear that we did evolve through a meat-eating phase because that's what the anthropology and the archaeology suggests. That doesn't mean that we can't be vegans. Clearly we can, but veganism is something that, back in prehistory, even way back in prehistory, we probably did eat a little bit of meat, as chimpanzees still do, but they don't eat a lot because they're not systematic about it. But most of what we think of as human culture evolved in small groups in which meat eating played a very powerful role. There's a really good book about this called Blood Relations, Menstruation, the Origins of Culture by Dr. Chris Knight, and it covers this whole area. But, of course, there's no reason, because we've evolved to eat meat, that we have to eat meat. And, in India, for example, the Brahmin caste who, sit at the top of the social hierarchy, they don't eat meat, which is bizarre because, in actual fact, they are descended from Aryan meat eaters who invaded India from the north. But things like that happened in history where not eating meat, even though you started off as a meat-eating kind of culture, becomes a mark of difference.
Isn't there a sort of sociological aspect to all of this where, a country, a person, a family that does eat meat is seen as more macho than ones that don't?
Well, I think what's the truth of the matter is that people's diets, like everything else about them, is part of their culture. And, of course, there's some cultures like, Jains in India don't eat meat. They're completely vegetarian because it's part of their religious beliefs not to harm any living thing. But, of course, the San people living in the Kalahari Desert, well, they do eat meat because there's not a lot grows there. And the same with Inuit people in the Arctic. They have to eat meat, or they traditionally had to, because not a lot grows there.
Okay,
and we're very adaptable, is the truth of the matter. We're adaptable.
Well, Justin is most definitely adaptable to not eating meat or honey or, I suppose, milk products. So anyway, what's turned you on to this, Justin?
Oh, it's been a bit of a process, I mean, I was not brought up as a vegan. I was brought up eating Sunday dinners and casseroles and all that sort of stuff like you would do in the 70s and that. And then, I guess probably about 10 years ago, I just started going down the vegetarian route. I certainly started before that, trying to cut meat out of my diet a little bit on certain days. You know, I'm not.
But
exactly
why was
say.
It an ethical or health?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, look, I think there's four strands to this. One is the kind of factory farming side of it all. I wasn't massively enamoured with that. Another one is that, you know, you can see capitalism right through the food chain. I wasn't massively enamoured with that. Then there was the kind of environmental aspect, and then there's the sort of health side to it as well. I'm probably going to do five here. I think you can roll up capitalism and factory farming together, and then lastly there's the environmental aspect of it, you know. So all of these things were kind of playing in my mind, you know. As someone on the left, I was thinking, you know, is it right for me to do this, is it right for me to do that? And I started off by cutting out or reducing certainly meat from my diet, and then eventually I cut out meat altogether, just ended up sort of pescatarian, then got rid of the fish, and then got rid of the dairy and the eggs.
So what do you most prefer now when you're having a meal?
What he's asking, what's
is it anything?
My favourite?
I mean, yeah, your favourite vegan meal. Yeah.
Whatever my partner cooks me is wonderful, you know what I mean? I can cook myself, obviously, and I cook for her as well, but it's nice to be cooked for. Look, I mean, I don't know anything in it, really. Curries is always a go-to. Listen, we call it vegan slop. I'm pretty self-deprecating about veganism, you know. I'm not a huge zealot for it, but I am an advocate. And, basically, whatever you can throw in a pan and cook up, bit of rice, bit of pasta with it, you know.
What about this? The ethical side about killing animals? I mean, I've written down three reasons here. One is the factory farming and the capitalism. Another is the environment. Obviously, it's better for the environment growing food as crops in many cases. There's quite a big argument for that, especially if it's not on hills and things like that, where you will get sheep, but you won't be able to grow your corn. And then health. So I've got those three. Any more? Have I missed something there?
Hang on.
So factory farming, environmentalism, and health. Because the thing with factory farming is that you can't tell a lot of the time. When you're buying something, you've got no idea if it was the animal was well treated, if it was traumatized in the state when it was. I mean, I don't know if you remember, but back in the would be the 1990s now. Channel 4 had a 2-week series, which was an amazing series called Banned. And they had some brilliant programs there, which they'd never show nowadays, because of course it hits profit margins and things like that. It's nothing to do really with the ethical side of it or squeamishness or whatever of it, people filming inside slaughterhouses. And the whole sort of chicken production line thing, it's interesting to see how it's done. It's, in a way, it's a form of psychosis to just block this thing out from your consciousness. So you buy a nicely wrapped chicken or a piece of chicken on a bit of polystyrene with a bit of cling film over it, and you're not thinking about what it is and how it got there.
So, as you were talking, I was thinking back. I mean, I've had friends in the past, you know, in the last sort of 20, 25 years who said to me, oh, if you see the red legs on chicken, that's because of the ammonia in their cages and stuff like that. And all of this sort of stuff gets you thinking. And one thing that's been really clear to me, I'm old enough to remember when, like, my parents would have chicken like twice a year. I mean, almost like turkey, pound for pound, was cheaper than chicken. And now it's one of the cheapest meats available. And you've got this thing of chickens coming to maturity in 6 weeks and then being slaughtered, et cetera, et cetera. And really, you know, you said you don't know how the animal's been treated, you don't know what's been injected into it, you don't know what it's eaten. You know, we've had CJD and stuff like that in the past, and questionable practices. Frankly, for me, the way you get rid of all of that is you don't eat any of it, you know, and then you don't have to worry about how it's been produced.
Well, hang on, because you still get the same sort of pesticides and things like that on a lot of the, I mean, say, for example, on lettuce, things like that. You buy in the, so you can't get away from this, really, can you? By just going over to eating plants.
So one thing you can do, I guess, is you can wash off whatever's on the surface. I appreciate you can't always get rid of what's inside that, but I think there's certainly less capacity for harm from the vegetables.
I'm going to break it to you now. A lot of these pesticides are oil-based, so you'd have to wash it with loads of fairy liquid to get it off, you know, if it was on the surface.
Yeah.
So
oil-based again, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just we basically should ban pesticides, I think, and we should only allow. In fact, if you go back, say, to the 1940s, 1950s, you'll find a lot of the animal welfare was much better, and it was a lot of small-scale farming. It's this factory farming you were talking about that's changed so much since then. So, Martin, there is obviously a big incentive to go for this factory farming. In fact, much of the things like chicken are not produced in this country anymore. They're imported, aren't they?
Well, no. I mean, what's actually happening in the Wye Valley, where I am at the minute, is the battery chickens, which have been grown up like mushrooms around here, have ruined the River Wye. It's absolutely polluted with chicken waste. What we should do, I mean...
Problem of regulation, isn't it? It's not being regulated.
Because factory farming, in fact, if you actually look at the economics of farming, big countries like the United States subsidise their farming. They've always done it. And it means it looks more efficient, but it isn't really.
Well, that's the whole of Europe doing that, isn't it?
Well, that's right. But the Europeans did it because the Americans were doing it. Otherwise, subsidised American stuff would have been it, would it all we get to eat. And that is what people get to eat in poor countries.
But can't we subsidise, say, organic food, healthy food?
Sorry?
Can't we subsidise only organic food, healthy food, that sort of thing?
If you're going to subsidise it, we could just subsidise the healthy stuff. But don't forget, there are vested interests. Once you've created a big factory farm industry, glyphosate, Monsanto, and all these other, you know, huge corporations trying to dominate the global food supply, and it's not just accidental. The US has always had a strategy of basically trying to dominate the world's food supply so that they can then tell people what to do. You know, if you're a Muslim country like Bangladesh and half of your food supply is supplied by subsidized American imports, then you don't want to vote against the US at the United Nations over Gaza.
Yes, this factory
will make it clear to you that you're not to do that.
This factory farming and industrial agriculture, is there anything we can do to stop it?
Because
it's
by the West, and the West wants to export their model to everybody else, and it's part of the general imperialism of the system. I mean, some guy spoke in the 70s. My PhD thesis was all about this, which I never finally completed. But he said we must destroy independent farmers now all over the world so that everybody will have to eat our stuff, which then gives us a geopolitical advantage. Now, one of the things that Russia has been able to do, because of course they used to have to import an awful lot of their food because their food system was so inefficient, they've now turned that round and they're the biggest food exporters, bigger than the Americans, but without subsidies. It's a real problem for the US. They don't know what to do about it. Which is why one of the aspects of the grain deal and the grain war in Ukraine has been so important and totally misrepresented in the Western media.
So, Justin, do you ever crave a bacon sandwich?
No, I don't.
Not at all, no?
No,
okay.
No, I'm way past that.
It's a bit like asking if you crave a cigarette when you've got to stop smoking.
Yeah, exactly.
What about this, what sort of farming would you like to see then out there that would supply this food without necessarily animals? Because you see, you've got lots and lots of land, which is marginal land, which is really only suitable for grazing livestock on.
Yeah, it's true. But then again, there is also a lot of lowland farming that gets used, or farmland that gets used as well. I mean, for example, you know, you'll go on the M4 now and you'll see the lorries bringing sheep from Wales, bringing them into like the Devizes area, Wiltshire, things like that, Marlborough Downs for the winter because they can lamb better down there, you know. So there is lower land farmland, for using land too much, that gets used for this. But yeah, I mean, I think really it's a stated fact that it takes far more land, far more agriculture. I was getting taught this in geography in the 80s to raise animals than it does to raise plants. And, you know, for me, that's the way forward. You know, you can get far more calories per hectare if you're raising vegetables than you can if you're raising animals.
Is that true, Martin?
Yep, pretty much true.
I mean, does that count around the world? Because you would think that any poor country that's having troubles, feeding its population, as we might be soon, it would have a national program really to go over to arable agriculture rather than livestock.
Well, I mean, we're talking now about the struggle to control your own policy. Full stop. I mean, in Mexico at the moment, the left-wing government in Mexico are refusing to allow genetically modified corn into Mexico, but they're being challenged under the North American Free Trade Agreement's disputes procedures so that subsidized U.S. corn can be forced on the Mexicans, which will have a dramatic impact on the traditional Mexican farmers who grow their own varieties of corn. Now, the average, you know, most people in Mexico are not vegetarians by principle. Nor in India, they're vegetarians because they can't afford meat. They only eat it very occasionally. They're not opposed to eating it, but they just can't afford it. And so these issues about access to land, who's going to control the food system, it isn't just about vegetarianism versus carnivorism, if you like. We've got to change to a better system all round, which will include reducing the amount of livestock, but perhaps not reducing it to zero. But of course, the real issue is the attempt to dominate the world food system by the Western multinationals, which is this is what the cause of war in Mexico. You know, this is why the Chiapas rebels rose up in the 1990s, because they were being pushed off their lands. The Ayudos system, which allowed everybody to have access to land, was dismantled. The land was privatized, and the U.S. multinationals moved in. And this is a life and death struggle for campesinos in Mexico and elsewhere around the world.
There's a lot of politics in food, isn't there, Justin?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, of course, vegans get accused of being radical and extreme and all this sort of stuff. And yeah, there are elements there. I wanted to say this, certainly one of my contributions was going to be, I think it is a revolution. I think it's a really quiet revolution. I think it's happening. I think the food companies are having to sit up and take notice of it. And also, it's a lot easier to do it these days. You know, there were some real hardcore pioneers in the 60s and the 70s who went before us and paved the way for people like me to kind of jump on the bandwagon more latterly. But, the availability of the products, and there's also a little bit of a time bomb in that, because there is still vegan junk food, for example. So that's not exactly going to cure the obesity crisis. So there's a lot to this, But yeah, in terms of the politics of it, I think it is moving in the right direction. I think it's a quiet revolution, and I think that big companies and even big pharma are sitting up and taking notice of it.
I mean, if you look at the history, you go back to the 17th century, for example, 18th century in the enclosures. This was a big change that most of the food that was grown before that was arable, was crops. I don't know if they had spinach in those days, your carrots, your turnips, neeps, as they used to call them, and that sort of thing. And as land was enclosed, Martin, privatized basically, so the big landowners found it was much more profitable to just, and they didn't need the human labor either, to just leave a bunch of sheep out there to procreate for a while, and then they could come back and take both the meat and the wool.
Well, the wool was what they were really after there. In the medieval times, the average peasant hardly ate any meat ever. They ate bread every day. They did
use beer, I think. You used to soak it in beer.
Yeah. Well, nobody drank water because you'd die. So that's why they had to drink. In Japan and China, big cities survived. They boiled water. They drank tea, whereas traditionally in Europe, people drank alcohol, and that's why Europeans are much less susceptible to alcohol. In other words, they can take more alcohol. Some people in Japan, I said, a friend of mine who's half Japanese, and if he even has a sip of alcohol, he's immediately very, very sick, and he just couldn't take it because the genetics evolved in a different way there.
And the point being that the alcohol somehow purified the water then, or what?
The alcohol kills germs, So you can't, if you drink water from polluted sources, you're going to die of cholera and diarrhea and so on. Diarrhea is still the main killer of children around the world through dirty water, and it's something that probably would cost, to provide people with decent water supply is a key demand all over the world, but it's never been fulfilled because, as we know, the demands of the poorest are swept aside, and the system doesn't take any account of what they need.
I think there was a sort of general agreement in this country, First World War and Second World War, maybe between the wars time, that it's nice to give people an allotment where they can grow a bit of their own food, because there was a lot of complaints that some of the new housing didn't give the people any land at all as an opportunity to grow anything. Are you a fan of allotments, Justin?
Yeah, I have tried to grow my own stuff. Certainly tried after lockdown. You know, I'm lucky. I live in a former council house, and I've got one of those gardens from the 50s, which is the size of an allotment. You know, so I have tried to do a bit. Not great at it. Like to be better. My mum and dad had allotments when I was a kid. So yeah, I'd say I'm probably verging on an allotment person without actually having one, you know.
I mean, this idea of a kitchen garden, Martin, it almost should be de rigueur for any, you know, if you're going to urbanise people, you need to give them a bit of land to grow some Brussels sprouts, a few cabbages, or whatever they want on.
Well, that's implying that you've got some kind of overall plan with human welfare at the heart of it.
Yeah, well, we have on this show. We have on this show. And actually, they did after the Second World War, didn't they?
Well, I mean, what happens in wartime is you're forced to adopt measures which you wouldn't have adopted otherwise. And that's really the only reason why we have any farming at all in this country, because the traditional goal of the ruling classes here was to keep food cheap so that they could keep wages down, which meant that they imported food. They imported bread from Canada, beef from Argentina, which was actually a British colony effectively, and lamb and wool from Australia. And you don't need to produce anything at home locally, because then you can concentrate on what you're really good at, which is knocking out, you know, machinery of various
types
and weaponry.
Yeah, battleships. I think that's what they seem to want to do. Anyway, we're going to have a listen now to the environmentalists who I worked with back in the 1990s, George Monbiot, and Guardian columnist, because he sort of seems to fall into a trap that he's almost deliberately set for himself here. I mean, we've been talking about the change in agriculture, the way that the governments have simply not regulated it properly, so that we've got far too much factory farming, intensive agriculture, almost like treating the countryside like the factory floor, and without any proper animal welfare, that sort of thing. And that's just been allowed to run riot. Hence, there's been very little caring for the environment in the same time, as you were talking about, Martin, with these discharges from the chicken farms ruining the rivers and this sort of thing. So it seems to me it's mainly a problem of the way it's regulated, and it would make a lot of sense, it seems to me, just simply to subsidise organic agriculture and ban pesticides, this sort of thing. Then people would just be able to get on with the job and produce healthy food. And as Robin Page was doing in his wonderful campaign until he died last year, and his trust was stolen off of him, I would use that word advisedly, by various people. He had about £50 million worth of farms donated to him, the Countryside Restoration Trust, where he wanted to integrate wildlife and farming on his farms. It's almost as if George's thesis pretends that none of this has ever happened, and that industrial agriculture is the only agriculture. Now, we know, of course, many people know that in Ireland, it's one of the largest number of small landowners in Europe, and that's largely due to the way that Ireland got its independence back in the 1880s and early 1900s. Loads and loads of little owner-occupier farmers over in Ireland. But anyway, so let's have a listen to George Monbiot now talking about the greatest threat to life being farming.
There's a fundamental truth which most people just don't want to hear, which is that the greatest threat to life on Earth is farming.
Farming?
No. Hang on a moment. It can't be farming.
Farming
is the greatest cause of habitat destruction, the greatest cause of biodiversity loss, the greatest cause of extinction, one of the greatest causes of climate breakdown, one of the greatest causes of water pollution, the greatest cause of soil destruction, the greatest cause of water loss. Tick, tick, tick. All those boxes. It's farming which comes out either right on top. Because every hectare of land that you're using for an extractive industry like farming is land not used for forests, for wetlands, for savannas, for all the other crucial habitats which are essential to prevent the collapse of our ecosystems, which will also lead to our destruction.
Well, I hate to tell him, but yeah, we're wetlands. Actually, you can't really farm on wetlands, and there's loads of them around. He's talking about this idea of farming being extractive. Well, yes, but it doesn't have to be just extractive. It's the idea is that certainly traditional farming, you would use manure of the animals and recycle that. You didn't need to have any kind of artificial fertilizers used on the land. You didn't need to have any pesticides used on the land. If you're using horses and you're using human labor, you don't actually need to have any diesel fuel to use on the land if you're plowing, for example, like that. And so, you know, he's almost, I wonder what you make of that, Justin. You know, this, it seems a very extreme statement to me, that the greatest threat to life on Earth is farming.
Well, I think, I mean, it's certainly provocative. And I think I'd go back to what I said, that I think veganism is a quiet revolution. I think it's something that's coming in very gradual waves. I think it's moving people. I mean, there's land in this country that was, for example, drained in the 17th century and stuff like that, you know, bringing in Dutch engineers to try and drain the wetlands, the fenlands and things like that in East Anglia. So, I mean, we've always done this. Is it too late to turn the clock back? Well, we're putting back peatlands in upland areas. I think there's wetlands that are being reintroduced, you know. So the main thing for me is, if we are going to eat less meat, then therefore we should be able to use more of the land that's used for meat, understanding what you're saying about the uplands, certainly in lowland areas, for vegetable, arable production. And that's, you know, going to be a way forward. And I think it's something that we need to start doing in this country before we start going and preaching to other people around
the
world.
Well, we're going to have to use a lot more diesel ploughing it up then, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, it's a possibility, isn't it? I mean, I was behind a truck the other day when I was driving myself, and that was advertising the fact that it was a diesel alternative or something like that, some gas or other, I don't know. But I mean, there's alternatives out there. It's going to be difficult, and it's difficult for us to divorce ourselves away from fossil fuels. But I mean, look, I think there's two ways to go here. Either we cut the fossil fuels out, and perhaps we continue producing calories through meat, or we go the other way and we start reducing the meat, you know what I mean? Personally, I want to see both edged out, but as I say, I think it's a gradual process. I don't think it's something that's going to happen overnight.
Martin?
Well, I think the idea that it's a gradual process is inevitable because, you know, to disentangle all of the injustices that are involved in the international food system is going to be a struggle. It isn't just going to happen just like that. And it isn't just a question of taking a moral... I mean, I perfectly respect your decision to be a vegan. There shouldn't be any problem with that for anybody. But you can't just force that on everybody, and they're not going to accept it if you try. Mm. What we're really... I mean, I think some of the issues come back to... You see, in Brazil, which is a classic example of what was going on, the best land in Brazil is used to produce soybeans to feed to pigs in China or to create or totally useless cattle ranches, within a few years, the land is degraded to produce burgers to be sold in the United States. Meanwhile, you've got millions of small farmers who could actually grow their own food on that land, not that land, because it's not really suitable. The best land in the country is used for all of that. Now, what you really need is a land reform that gives the best land in the country to the small farmers, and you cut out completely the export, beef exports and all the rest of it. But that would require a revolution, and that revolution is often a violent revolution. You saw in Nicaragua, we've got an elected government there, Sandinista government, but they've been booted out twice by the Americans. There's been a huge civil war in which tens of thousands of people have died, many of them civilians killed by the Contras. These things are not just a question of why don't we all go green and give each other a cuddle. The struggle for land rights in developing countries is a bloody revolutionary struggle. I mean, that's one of the reasons, I'll just finish on this, why China has got such a relatively successful economy today is because they actually liquidated the previous landowning class. They got rid of them all completely and took the land off them. And that meant that they could surge forward. Countries that haven't done that, like Brazil, not so much.
Have you noticed any kind of health effects? How long have you been a vegan?
Well, look at me, Tom. I mean, you can tell, can't you? Just a picture of health, you know? I mean, certainly. I mean, when I went vegetarian, I did lose half a stone pretty quickly. You know, yeah. Just not really changing anything.
That's protein, I guess, is it?
Yeah, possibly so. You know what I mean? Possibly so. Not so much lately. And as I say, as I've got more vegan, there's been more vegan junk food produced. You know what I mean? So it's probably not helping. You know, even McDonald's do vegan burgers now, don't they?
Oh, right. Okay.
So, but yeah, you know, I mean, I think so, yeah. And I mean, really, one of the health things is, as I said, I didn't really want to put hormones and stuff in my body from the beef. I appreciate what you said about,
well, and chicken as well. Yeah, all sorts of weird stuff goes into the chicken,
you know. And also there's the thing about, I mean, when I was eating fish, when I sort of transitioned from meat and to just eat fish, and then you're hearing about all the plastic in the fish, and then I'm thinking, oh, I don't want to feed this to my kids, you know what I mean? So all this and that. So I really hope there's some benefits. I mean, they do say that, you know, it should reduce your cholesterol and your blood pressure and stuff like that. Look, I've had some issues with that, and I've had to cut some other things out, caffeine, alcohol, etc., you know what I mean? So yeah, I'm living like a monk these days, Tony.
Oh gosh, well, amazing. Well, you're looking pretty good on it.
Thank you very much.
You know, so the other thing before, so let's finish, you know, so we could talk about food all night probably, you know, on this show, definitely, as we get a little bit hungry as it comes towards 8 o'clock, we go and get some supper, is the idea of this little lab grown food, because I mean, I think I'm suspicious that this is kind of on a kind of underground supply of this has been around for quite a while, and that it's just really a question of trying to convince the public that it's a good thing, it's going to be really healthy, it's going to be cool. Monbiot is another one of those people that's been really pushing this, as well as this whole idea of eating insects, growing insects to be eaten, saying, well, if you're not going to get protein from beef, we've looked at all the carbon sort of side of all of this, maybe they have, maybe they haven't, and we think that actually insects are far more palatable. But what do you make of those two? Firstly, the lab-grown meat,
because
it's a whole industry supposed to be growing up. The most recent news I've heard on this a few weeks ago was one of these lab-grown meat companies going bust in the States, because a lot of money had gone into it, a lot of big expectations, this was going to be a great big new thing, and it was a bit of a flop. So anyway, what do you think of those?
If it was a flop, maybe they weren't doing it right. I mean, I'm personally not a fan, you know. Again, a lot of it was about the sort of ethical stuff and about what's going into the food, et cetera, et cetera. Appreciating I'm going to be picking up some chemicals from the vegetables, I'm just trying to reduce it as much as possible. So not a great fan of the lab grown, certainly not a fan of the insect side of things. You know, not because I've particularly got anything against eating insects any more than I have against eating animals. I think they're still an animal. I think they're still a living creature. I don't want to eat them any more than I want to eat a chicken or a cow. So
would you step on a wasp?
Well, I try not to, Tony. I really try
an
not
ant?
To, you know. Yeah, I try not. I really do try not to, you know what I mean?
So are humans animals?
Well, yeah, and I'm not going to eat them either, right?
No. Well, I mean, I come from a school of thought that thinks we're not animals, we're humans, and animals are different. And maybe that's one of those mindsets that thinks, yeah, it's okay to eat one of those, but not one of those. Martin, what do you think? Yeah.
Well, the lab-produced meat is, I mean, if we're meat-eating isn't going to disappear overnight, and those who want to eat meat, and I think it should be a treat rather than an everyday thing, but they want to eat meat. They don't want to eat lab-produced meat. I mean,
by the way, we're using the wrong expression. Sorry to interrupt you, but it's now called, as of a few weeks ago, cultured meat. The idea is lab-grown meat has not been very good. People haven't found that that's the sort of thing that they want to pick off the supermarket shelf. So, Martin, you must use this new phrase. Big Brother has determined it's now called cultured meat.
Yeah, well, the thing is, this is going to be dominated by big multinational companies, even if it's successful. You're not talking about small farmers having a few sheep or a pig, are we? And this is what's so pernicious about it, is because it reinforces the power structure within the agricultural system in the wrong direction. And the insects are eaten in certain parts of the world, and they have been for hundreds of years. If you go to East Africa, they have a huge amount of these flies come out once a year, and they gather them all up and they turn them into little patties and they eat them. I'm not dogmatic about where people get their protein, but it's more a question for me of what's the power structure behind all of this. Why are you eating, you know, lots of in Colombia, for example, when I was over there in a trade union delegation, we were there to support Coca-Cola workers who were being murdered, you know, the trade union leaders were being murdered by paramilitaries. And the Coca-Cola industry was, you know, pushing Coca-Cola down onto the youth of Colombia. Meanwhile, in Colombia, you've got all of these beautiful fruits, papayas and all the rest of it, absolutely beautiful natural fruit juice. But the system, you know, you're not anybody unless you're drinking a Coca-Cola from a Coca-Cola can, you know, with the registered trademark. And these struggles about control of people's diet are fundamental to the political struggles of the whole planet. You can't get round it. Food is, you know, every day we sit down.
Could it be, Martin, that private equity firm wants the land, and so they're just saying, well, we're not going to give you enough land to have meat as well as vegetables. All you can have is vegetables now.
Well, they're dominating the whole thing. I mean, basically, they want to. What should happen in developing countries, and it did happen in Southeast Asia, is that small farmers were benefited by, firstly, by what the communists did in China, and then they were copied. In Japan, the traditional landowning class were pushed out at the end of the Second World War. In Taiwan, the same. In South Korea, the same, even though it was a military government, right-wing military government. They got rid of the traditional ruling class. And that's actually an essential step towards industrialization. The way that Britain industrialized, by driving everybody off the land and then bringing imported food in, was a method of industrializing, but it's not the best method. Those that are playing catch-up in Southeast Asia haven't destroyed their... Japanese traditional farming remains very similar to what it's always been. And, for example, until quite recently, you couldn't buy in Japan rice produced anywhere else. So South Koreans turned up for an expo and they got rice on their table where they're showing their products. It was confiscated by the Japanese police. You can't do that around here. Japanese rice for Japanese people. And that sort of thinking is exactly what we haven't got here. In Britain, we could never have fed ourselves at the best of times because we don't grow bananas and things like that. But the culture here has always been we're going to get food in from outside.
Yeah, well, problem, it seems to me, a lot of the problem is to do with labelling. I don't know what you think as a vegan. I mean, a lot of food is just simply not, there's no labelling as to, for example, there is, you know, whether pesticides are on it, for example, seems to me obviously labelled and then no one would buy it. The other thing is irradiation of food. A lot of food gets irradiated. There was a struggle about 20 years ago to say this must be labelled on the food if it's been irradiated, and of course no one would buy it. So this seems to me a very important. I mean, for example, with the lab-grown meat, which I'm afraid to still call it lab-grown meat, is that there is a big battle going on to make sure that isn't labelled either. But in June this year, cultivated chicken grown from stem cells in a bioreactor, was officially approved for commercial sale in the United States for the first time ever. American diners could tuck into chicken produced without harming a single bird. Instead, stem cells harmlessly drawn from donor animals would be raised in a soup of nutrients in a bioreactor compared to conventional meat. Meat from stem cells promises to need much less land and far fewer greenhouse gases. It also tastes the same, apparently, as meat from an animal, mainly because it is real meat, only not from a slaughtered animal. A triple win for people, animals, and the planet, says Yahoo Life. Actually, they are, in this interview, they're chatting to one of the proprietors of one of these lab-grown meat companies. I'll put a link up to that interesting little article. It's trying to sell you it, basically. It looks like an advert for lab-grown meat, but actually it's framed as an article. But Martin, this is what they're saying is effectively this is going to happen, mate, and ain't nothing you can do about it.
Well, as I say, what I would prefer is have people having a few chickens and a pig on a small holding. And not buying it from supermarkets or whatever, which is, of course, exactly what you're talking about in rural Colombia or Nicaragua. And they don't, you know, the pig they keep for a year and then probably eat it at Christmas. And that's the only meat you're going to get. Most of the rest of the time you're going to be eating beans. But, of course, if you've got a lab-produced meat, who's going to own that lab-producing meat factory? It isn't going to be run by Farmer Jones, is it? It's going to be run by Monsanto. And... you know, that's immediately just tells you what's going on.
There's a bit of a tug of war going on in Romania. Their Senate has voted to ban the sale of all lab-grown synthetic meat. So this future over our food supply, What do you make of a little argument I put forward there, Justin, that actually we're being nudged towards all being vegetarians or vegans because the big private equity firms want the land. They're buying up a lot of land at the moment. Farmers are finding it very difficult to buy farmland, to extend farms. If they've got a little farm, they're finding it very difficult to do that. One of the reasons they're buying the land up is to plant trees on it to offset carbon. Okay. So, say, for example, British Rail, they burn diesel fuel, so they have to now buy these carbon credits from these private equity firms, and they say, oh, we'll plant a tree for you. Mm-hmm. And so that land is being used for that kind of thing instead of farming.
I mean, I suppose it's going back to what you were reporting George Monbiot was saying in that respect. I think it is, as I said, it's a very gentle way forward. I think that becoming a vegan allows me to kind of satisfy myself. You know, I don't feel like I'm hurting or injuring anything else that's living. And I think you then influence the people around you. Yeah, I'm absolutely interested in big farming, big commercial, you know, operations and stuff like that. I don't want to see fossil fuels offset by, you know, venture capitalists or whatever buying up the land. On the other hand, if they're planting trees, then to some extent, it's got to be better than perhaps arming animals. So, you know, so it's not my favourite. I'm not going to say that I'm going to jump on board this kind of bandwagon. The bandwagon that I'm on is being a vegan, staying a vegan for the rest of my life, and hopefully taking some personal benefits from it and hopefully influencing people around me to join me on that journey, even if it's one day a week.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, I mean, to me, it seems obvious that there is a benefit, I mean, almost in karma terms, in not harming animals. And every time you pick up a piece of meat from the supermarket shelf, you're harming an animal. Yeah, in a way, you should get a little electric shock, it seems to me, every time that happens, just to remind you.
You mean like they do before they end up on the shelf?
Well, they're outsourcing the, you know, anyone that does that, and I'm included in this, you know, you're outsourcing the pain. You're outsourcing the anguish. But then again, Martin, maybe we can finish. I said we're going to finish. We're going to finish on this one now. Is actually, if there was no livestock farming, those animals wouldn't be around at all, would they?
Well, that's right. I mean, they've evolved and been bred by us for what they're used for. I would suggest that the rational way forward is, yes, we want to reduce meat overeating by wealthy consumers in the West. But in actual fact, you know, for some rural communities in Mexico or whatever, having an extra chicken a month might be a good idea. But I'm not dogmatic about it. And I don't think that Justin's being dogmatic about what he's saying either. And what I would bring forward is, look who's in control of all of this. These people that are saying we're going to save the world by offsetting your carbon emissions by planting trees. I don't believe. I mean, you know, what sort of trees are they? You know, I mean, who, you know,
they're very nice little trees.
Yes, I know, but
the whole trees.
I do not believe that the multinational corporations that have created the mess we're in are the people to lead us out of that mess.
Yeah, it's a land grab, really, isn't it? It's not like Gaza, but
we've got to reform them, and we can't get rid of them straight away. But the idea that they're going to tell us how to solve the problems, no.
Yeah, it's just a kind of another form of enclosures, it seems to me, another land grab. Anyway, on to teaching. The British government is keeping files on teaching assistants and librarians' internet activities. The Department for Education is monitoring social media posts from England-based staff, any of which might be critical of its policies. And this is in this week's Guardian Observer. 2 weeks ago, the newspaper revealed how the Department for Education is monitoring the social media activity of the country's leading education experts. Now, evidence has emerged that its monitoring is much more widespread, covering even teaching assistants. Martin, well, you're a teaching assistant, so I imagine your internet trail is quite an interesting one to follow. Maybe you're blowing their mind.
Well, I mean, it was originally there were academics who were experts in early years education. And they were uninvited to conferences because the government said that they were critical of government policy, which is outrageous if you think about it. I mean, these people are the experts on early years education, and we can tell they can't go to conferences if they don't agree with the Tory government's policy. But it's now come out that they're actually monitoring right down to my level of people being teaching assistants and no doubt teachers as well. And
this is Big Brother. It's Big Brother, well, isn't it? I mean, the idea is that they want to know.
We've got a financial crisis.
You're a potential thought criminal, and all your colleagues are.
Yes, well, but what's making people really angry about this is there's a financial crisis in education. There's a cost of living crisis. We've just been through a whole series of strikes. The concrete is rubbish in loads of schools. They've had to be closed. Meanwhile, the Department of Education is spending taxpayer money and time monitoring our views about education. I mean, for God's sake, we are educationalists. Of course we've got views about education, and some of those views ain't going to be what the government wants to hear. But why is the government wasting money, our money, on monitoring those views so that they can discipline people who they don't like?
Well, it seems to me that the point of this is not necessarily even to tell the person involved why they've been stopped from going to a conference, maybe even why they've been sacked from their school. It's like a kind of Stasi situation where you're keeping a file on this person, and if you don't like what you see, you're going to find a way to get rid of them.
Yeah, I think it's all part of that element of control. I'm always surprised at how readily any employer reaches for discipline. There's clearly better ways of dealing with things. The one thing I would say is that we are always really clear with trade union members. I've worked for a teaching union, I've worked for a civil service union. We are absolutely clear. Do not comment on your working day. Do not comment on your employer. Anything that you do in that respect could be used against you. It's a clear no-no.
Well, we do at the New Media Industrial Council and the Journalists Union, we had a very interesting discussion, must be more 10, 15 years ago now, and produced a report for journalists about not getting sacked by saying the wrong thing on social media. And most of the advice had to do with keeping your account anonymous. Simple as that. You know, so I suppose there are ways that they maybe go to bribe and pay Twitter or whoever to tell them who you are. But it seems by far the best way of doing things to, just stay anonymous. And sometimes journalists felt that it was part of their duty as a journalist to tweet about their employer and say things which were not popular about their employer. And we'll be looking now, in a minute anyway, at this has kind of popped out at me this week, you know, through various different sources, including our old friend Sunday Times Richlist journalist Kevin Carhill, talking about the Murdoch Empire and their use of, we won't talk about it now, we're talking about it in a little while, their use of the Israelis' use of money to bribe either TikTokers or massive media outfits like the Murdoch Empire to be supportive. So when you're hearing them saying, oh, yes, it's fine to bomb Gaza, you know, no one should question the Israelis, they're doing a great job, then it might simply be that Rupert Murdoch has got a massive wedge of cash from them. But we're hearing a bit more about that in a minute. And part of this, I suppose, is, you know, this sort of move towards new types of food is the danger, it seems to me, is that much of this will be managed not by human beings, but by artificial intelligence and by computers. I wonder if you've seen that in your work with PCS, is there an attempt to actually outsource human beings' work to computers and reducing the amount of input that individuals have?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a discussion, and I think we can certainly feel it coming through in the civil service. I think the interesting thing is it's going to be affecting the middle managers more than anything. You know, people who've got to produce reports and things like that and do the same type of reports over and over. Well, it's a no-brainer that you're going to put that into an AI system and just, you know, put in the information, it will format it for you and spit it out again. And that could save you huge amounts of time. So I think the danger area for civil servants in this country is more in the middle ranks, you know, rather than the lower grade work, which, you know, in some instances is so low grade that it just couldn't be done by machines at present.
Well, look, we goes all the way from targeting Russians using the Palantir software, using satellites and drones, all being done by AI, or maybe out in Libya, I think, where was the first admitted targeting and killing of people was done by AI, right the way down to call centres where, you know, you've got some sort of AI bot that you're chatting with rather than a human being. But anyway, today, Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister, allegedly the Prime Minister, from Goldman Sachs, has announced the UK AI Safety Institute, I think it was yesterday actually, but declines to support a moratorium. Right, so the PM has said the Institute will test new types of AI for a range of risks, but no pause in developing powerful models, Martin. So it seems as if this is exactly the sort of thing that the industry would want, is developing all this, which is that we want to be the regulators, but for now we're just going to let the AI industry do whatever it wants.
Well, I mean, Britain isn't at the forefront of this, so there's an element of Rishi Sunak trying to find anything that he can make a comment on which isn't going to cause trouble for him, because he's obviously got trouble in every department. So the people are quite surprised about this incoming, you know, because he's going to ban smoking as well. Did you see that? From they're going to try and bring this forward where, as they have in New Zealand, where gradually the younger people will not be able to buy cigarettes. That's because he doesn't like smoking. I think an element of this, I mean, there's a worthy discussion to have about AI, but there's an element of Rishi Sunak here just trying to think of anything to say to keep the media happy that he's got some kind of project of some kind on the go. But the big issues about AI are obviously out there, but Britain on its own is not a major player. So anything we decided to do, the Americans and the Chinese and all the rest of it, we're not going to influence them. But we'll have to see what they do and adapt to that, won't we?
Another story this week. It's not in the papers or whatever, but it was something I picked up on Radio 5 Live as they're talking about the problems with policing generally. Is this whole idea of private policing and the former Scotland Yard police officer Peter Blexley? He was speaking I think it was on Talk Radio last week about this. And so maybe we could just get a comment from you, Martin, and from you, Justin, about this whole idea of the police not arresting people. I mean, this does seem to be going on. We're going to hear some examples of it in a minute. And companies are being set up who will do private prosecutions, and you have to pay them. If you've got some evidence that someone has stolen your stuff or whatever, has been robbing you or defrauded you, then you can take the information to them and they will start doing private prosecutions where the police aren't interested. So what do you make of this development, Martin?
Well, in the US it's very, very advanced, and of course it's the privatization of the commons. You know, the whole thing of the police should not be a commercial organization, you know, and when people are put in prison, it should not be a profit-making exercise, as it clearly has become in the United States of America. With the highest proportion of people in prison in the world, you've got what they call the prison industrial complex, because these people are made to work for private companies while they're in prison. And, you know, the whole three strikes and you're out thing. So you get busted three times for possession of marijuana and then you get sent down for 20 years. The privatization of the public sphere that's implied by having private police is simply wrong.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to, as I was saying, Peter Blexley. He's a former Metropolitan Police Scotland Yard detective. And here he is explaining how this company, TMI, when the police won't investigate for you, these guys, you can pay them and they'll do it instead.
Now, has law and order broken down to such a degree that the public are now increasingly relying on so-called private police firms? The Daily Telegraph reports that a suspected burglar was taken to court by a private security firm called TMI, founded by a former Scotland Yard chief inspector. This is amid growing concerns that police don't care about so-called low-level crime. Delighted to be joined in the studio by former Met Police detective Peter Blexley. Thanks for coming in, Peter. What's your view on this? I mean, to sort of elaborate on what happened, a guy was caught nicking stuff in Marks and Spencer's. Marks and Spencer's had hired private guards, security guards. They took the case to the police. They had plenty of evidence, so they caught him red-handed. The police declined to prosecute, so the private police company said, damn it, we'll prosecute. So they took him to court and successfully prosecuted. What are the police playing at here?
Well, their action do not match the words of their senior police, who have told us recently, of course, that they're going to investigate every crime. Well, that, quite frankly, was a promise that just can't be kept, because they claim they're too busy, they don't have enough officers. And there are time and time again repeated instances of people going to the police and getting no service whatsoever. This company, TMI, they also have a sister company called My Local Bobby. And I need to make it crystal clear, I have no connection with them whatsoever. I know the founder, David McKelvey, but
he's
former detective chief inspector. Okay. And he was a vocational cop and he was a very good detective. Mm-hmm. Very good. And he set up these companies. And basically, they're doing the police's work in many, many places. They work in conjunction with what are called BIDs, B-I-Ds, Business Improvement Districts, mm-hmm. a lot of them. And they employ not only their uniformed officers that patrol and detain shoplifters, but also their plainclothes detectives who go out there undercover and arrest shoplifter after shoplifter and also detain people for some other pretty serious crimes.
Well, other serious crimes like shoplifting, that's not actually that serious a crime. But the point is, Martin, this is a failure of the police, private companies stepping in to do private prosecutions for people.
Well, it's like people on NHS waiting list deciding to go private because they can't wait 14 months for a hip replacement. It's the wearing down of the public sphere, and it's not just because there is an epidemic of shoplifting going on at the moment. I understand, and you can understand why the police don't, because if they take all of these cases to court, the courts will be clogged up, the prisons are overflowing. You know, they're saying stop sentencing people because we haven't got any more room for people.
If there is an epidemic in shoplifting, maybe this is part of the move for everyone to be buying things online. I mean, the whole retail sector seems to be deliberately being slowly collapsed. What do you make of all this, Justin?
I mean, so many faults. I was in Tesco this morning, quite early on. The only people pushing trolleys around were the Tesco workers, you know, doing the shopping for people who are going to have it delivered later. So there's clearly no shoplifting there, is there? And that's one way of stopping it, right? On the other hand, what have they done? They've just basically outsourced their work to us. So if we do go in with a trolley, we check out ourselves now, don't we? And there's an element of trust there. And let's be honest, they must be making millions of pounds out of that, otherwise they wouldn't have even started doing that. Mm. And yet they're moaning about their profits and about the stealing. There's the people who are actually getting affected are the working people who are having to confront, you know, sometimes violent people who now have the capacity to shoplift because they don't have to go through a till, for example.
Well, and also, I mean, the police just refusing to turn up for things. And there's a terrific story on 5 Live this week by a chap called Stephen in Derbyshire, who explains that he rumbled some, not quite car thieves, car fraudsters who were trying to con him into taking 2/3 off the value of his car using various techniques, which he'll explain in a minute, called up the police and said, look, I mean, I can phone them up, get them to come here and you can arrest them. And the police weren't interested. So you do wonder what on earth they're doing. Maybe they're busy, but they've come up with some other excuse why they don't want to organise this. They don't want to arrest this organised criminal gang, which has been told about by a member of the public. So let's have a listen to Stephen in Derbyshire now, talking on 5 Live this week.
I tried to sell a car back in April of this year. Tried to sell a Range Rover for £10,000 on Auto Trader. The three people turned up. They came and looked at the car. They distracted me. One distracted me around the back whilst the two went round the front. I then went round the front and somebody else went round the back. I'd got it all on dash cam as it happened. So we took it out for a test drive. There was smoke coming out of the exhaust. Never had smoke coming out of the exhaust before. There were sensors on the dashboard were just coming. There was lights coming off everywhere. I was thinking, oh, my God. Got it back home. They said they wanted the car, the actual shell itself. They didn't want the engine, so they offered me £4,000 for it. I spoke to my wife, and she was the governing factor on this one, as usual. And she told me not to sell it to them. She said, "Don't sell it. We'll have somebody else look at it." I looked on the dash cam straight after they'd gone, because they kept phoning me and texting me and messaging me, coming back to me wanting to buy the car, which seemed suspicious in itself. But we looked on the dash cam, and there they were. They'd got them banged to rights, so to speak. It's clear as daylight. I'd got all three of them on camera. One of them had put oil in the coolant. One of them had disconnected sensors. It was so slick. The outfit was so slick. It literally took them seconds to do the jobs that they'd done. And of course, I contacted the police straight away after they'd gone, and the police didn't want to know. I was telling them that you can come and collect them. I'd phone them up and tell them to come and pick the car up and you can have them. But the police didn't want to know for 6 weeks. Eventually they took a statement from me, and they took all the dash cam footage. And now we've found out that the culprits have gone. They're not to be found anywhere. So there we go. Yeah, the police had just left it way, way, way too late.
Yeah. And did you eventually sell the car for what you wanted to sell it for?
Yeah, I had to drain everything out. It cost me probably £150 to get it all sorted, but they're obviously doing it to everybody, because that's how the police know about them. You mentioned this hot state. They definitely worked on that, because there was oil and there was lights on the dashboard everywhere. They definitely worked me into that hot state, because I panicked. I very, very, very nearly sold it to them. Because I know exactly how much the problem, if it had have been the real problem, how much it would have cost me to have had it fixed. So I was very, very close to taking their offer. It was only my wife's words saying, "No, don't do it. We've never had any problems with the car before. Why now?" So it was, it was definitely a hot state. The police have said it was an organised crime group, and the guy is well known to them, but they just can't find him. And I was there, I was ready to hand him to them on a plate. But again,
that's frustrating.
They said it's, what's it?
Entrapment.
I can't think of the word. Entrapment, that's the word. Yeah,
listen,
entrapment.
Stephen.
It would have been entrapment.
Yeah, so that was Stephen in Derbyshire. I imagine it's the Derbyshire police we should be pointing the finger at here. Don't really seem to be doing their job. At all. Martin, maybe you could just wind up talking about this. And it does seem as if the police are a bit risk averse, which is no good at all, is it? I mean, I'll put a link up on our show page to the full interview with Peter Blexley and with Stephen in Derbyshire there, because I think it's a fascinating insight into the failures of modern policing. It's not just about money, Martin. This is also about the police's willingness to do the job.
Well, as the word used at the end of that clip was entrapment. And as professional police officers, they will know, they put these people in front of a jury, the defence lawyers are going to say that was entrapment.
Well, they can try, but obviously
they've
got all the evidence that it wasn't entrapment, that they were genuinely trying to buy the vehicle, and they would have bought the vehicle for a much lower price if they'd got away with it. That's not entrapment at all.
Well, no, because it'd be... What they'll say is, if he calls them in and then they come in and the police arrest them, that could be construed as entrapment in a court case. And presumably these guys will have lawyers to defend themselves if they've got money or if they can get legal aid. You know, a lot of things are let go by the police because they know they can't get a conviction in court from it. And it's all very well people criticise. I'm not saying the police should be above criticism, but often people just don't understand.
Martin, that isn't the only case, is it? The police have told him that they know this gang is out there. They've been doing it to other people too. So you would think that it would be, open and shut. Anyway, so Justin, do you want to just give us a final comment on that, and also anything else you'd like to talk about? Maybe you could say something about... I mean, we had an interesting conversation, I don't know how many months ago, where you were expressing some sort of scepticism as to whether the Conservatives actually really wanted to win next year's general election.
Oh, okay. Well, probably I did, and I don't think they're doing much about it.
It seems to be coming true, doesn't it? We have this amazing, the incredible.
You're going to say I was right all those months ago?
Well, absolutely right. Yeah. we're something like, is it a 24% swing in Scotland? In last week's by-elections, Tamworth and another one, which gives Starmer a majority, amazingly. I mean, that's where it's looking like.
Yeah, I heard that, and they said it would be like an unheard of majority, wouldn't it, if that was replicated right across the country. I mean, I really, as someone on the left, I really do despair of some of the stuff that Starmer's Labour Party are doing. It's not massively in tune with my feeling around it, and I think it's the Tories just basically self-harming and finding no way out of it. The thing that really hurts me is now, in my 50s, I'm old enough to remember this scenario probably twice, three times in my life. This feels very much like the major government. You know, they've just run out of ideas, run out of things to sort of change and sabotage, and now they're just kind of running on empty up until they get to this election. And then what we're going to get? We're going to get the sort of equivalent of Blair in 97, who kind of comes in, says all the right stuff, and, you know, maybe bar the minimum wage, does nothing.
Well, as we're going to hear in a minute, doesn't necessarily say the right stuff about Gaza. But anyway, look, Justin Thomas, thanks ever so much for coming in, particularly, you know, talking a little bit about veganism and explaining, you know, what it is and what it means. And I'm also joined in the studio, seamlessly there, by Mark Smullyan, who's a Jewish musician who's joined us to talk a bit about, we're going to get into talking about Gaza. Maybe before you go, Justin, you might just want to kick off and say what you make of what's been going on over there over the last, well, it's coming up for 3 weeks now. We've had the Hamas attack on Israel, and then the bombing of Gaza, basically, and the siege where very little food, water, etc. is being allowed into these 2 million people. The Israelis are saying they're trying to exterminate Hamas, but they're not letting anybody else out either.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I don't think you can condone any of it, you know. I mean, clearly we don't want to see incursions from Gaza into Israel, killing, you know, older people, younger people, men, women, children, you know, we just don't want to see that sort of stuff. I think the retaliation is way out of context. I think it's a retaliation that's been going on for decades. I think that guitarist was right to bring that up. And I think I'm also stunned at the way that the media line that's taken on all of this, you know, and the sort of disproportionate response. I think the thing that's really been fascinating me in the last few days is this thing around ceasefire and pause, you know. I mean, I think for most of us as rational people, we want to see any kind of warfare stopped. And, you know, and I think there's been that poll done in this country.
Well, hang on, because the Israelis are saying, well, if you just stop, then that gives Hamas the advantage. They came in and killed loads of us, and we haven't had the chance to get back at them at all.
I think that's a really difficult concept, this chance to get back at people, you know, this chance to take revenge,
etc. It's not just that, is it? They want to eliminate Hamas, which is understandable, isn't it?
I understand that, and in the process, you know, I mean, I don't really want to see any of this kind of visited on a civilian population, be it Israeli or be it Palestinian. I mean, this really does need to stop. I was going to just say that I don't really understand this thing of pause, because pause is almost like, well, you can stop for breath and then you can carry on again. And I just really don't like that concept that you can do something immensely destructive, have a pause, and then go back to doing something immensely destructive. In my mind, ceasefires are about stopping the killing and the slaughter and then finding a better way out of it. This idea of a pause, I just think is outrageous, frankly.
Anyway, Mark, what do you make of what's been going on over the last 3 weeks in Gaza and in Israel?
All right. I need to lay out a little bit who I am to make things really, really clear about what I'm about to say after that. As a Jew in the world, I've been pushed into a place which I only thought would happen or was past, that my parents were pushed into. So I'm going to start from a different angle, and we'll come back to it, I'm sure, but I just want to throw this in the mix. We are seeing a massive rise of anti-Semitism in the world. What has that got to do with what's going on in Israel? That's question one, and that will go back to the whole issue of Guterres. Is that how you pronounce his name in in the head of the UN, Gutierrez. So I'm not scared because I'm too old to be scared of anything. But, I'm seeing young people turn around and saying, my God, for the first time in my life, I'm actually scared that I happen to have been born Jewish. And they just happen to be, they don't feel like they're Jewish. They're just people who happen to be born Jewish, like other people happen to be born of whatever ethnic group they happen to be born to. And then all of a sudden, you know, they wake up one morning and they realize that they've been associated with something that really has nothing to do with them. So that's A.
Okay, but hang on, because I want to question that, because we've seen attacks on synagogues, that sort of thing, haven't we, over the years? Quite a few in this country, particularly in London. Yeah. So surely that's nothing new.
It's not new, but we're seeing, an enormous, anti-Semitic occurrences have risen 650% in the last 3 weeks. So there's a linkage between what's going on with Israel and Palestine and the Hamas and the way people are looking at the world Jewry. I just want to bring that up as a point to think about because why are they connected to it? It's like saying, in Pakistan, people are dying. I'm just kind of, people are dying of X, Y, or Z because of negligence. So are the British people who happen to be of Pakistani heritage responsible for what's going on in Pakistan? I understand why it's going on, but I don't accept that linkage one bit, because I'm a British citizen. I also happen to be an Israeli citizen, and I wanted to lay this out from the beginning. I was born here in the UK. I moved to Israel. Quite naive, found myself in a combat unit when I was 18, found myself in a situation in the West Bank where I couldn't believe, where the thought that went through my mind was, what is a British kid who loves to play the guitar doing here in the middle of whatever when he should be down at the local smoking a fagging, having a beer? And I'm like, how did I end up here? And it's not that my worldview changed, but I've got focus. I've always been from a kind of socialist, empathetic, liberal background, but I recognized that something was a bit of a quagmire here. Something was not correct. And my worldview solidified, and I have been an active proponent of the rights of the Palestinian people to self-determination. And I use that term because I don't want to decide how that would express itself at this point. Is it cantons? Is it two states? Is it this or that or federation? So, but they, I have been there. I have supported that. I co-founded a band with Palestinians before anybody even thought about it. I have been actively engaged with that, and in the end I got up and left and came back home because I was exhausted from this uphill push. So my credit in that space is, I think, pretty clear. I have friends who have family in Gaza, and I have nephews down on the border outside Gaza at this moment. Not a great place to be emotionally, morally. Now, regarding what's going on, is it Justin?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Justin. Regarding what's going on in Gaza, I'm horrified at the amount of people dying in Gaza. I don't think this was a smart reaction, though if we dig down international law, actually, it's actually by international law about war and engagement, it's actually still quite legal. But I don't want to go there because that's a moral issue as well. And who decides the lines of what's legal and not legal in warfare? What's horrifying me also is the misunderstanding and the buying into a really big mistake. And the big mistake is to think for 1 second that the Hamas has anything to do with the Palestinians, and or they really care or represent Palestinian right to self-determination. And the easiest way to see that is if they really cared about the Palestinians, they wouldn't have done what was not an attack or a military attack, but a brutal atrocity, which was, war crimes beyond belief. They wouldn't have done that because they knew what the reprisal was going to be. So if you care about your people, you don't set them up to be slaughtered, okay? So that's a point that just has to be acknowledged. The second thing is the kind of separation of what happened in Israel to innocent civilians, okay? Four-year-old children, two-month-old children are not responsible for the actions of the Israeli government, who I have nothing but kind of despair let me make it clear. I think our government is really gone completely berserk and with no connection even to what's going on with Gaza. I just think they're a bunch of basically dysfunctional and delusional people. But a four-year-old child, a 15-year-old girl who's raped, and the mother of the child is called up on the cell phone and the guy says, you know, listen while I'm raping your daughter. Now, they went in, the Hamas, with GoPro cameras. And I have to ask myself what people are actually proud to show what they're doing. You know, even the Nazis tried to hide it a lot. You know, they didn't like come out because they recognized that it was kind of not acceptable in the new moral code of Europe of post-First World War. So what's the scariest thing about the whole thing is that I look around me as I'm walking down the streets in our wonderful United Kingdom, who's going through extraordinary issues as well about, you know, freedom of speech and all sorts of stuff we could spend hours and hours talking about, and freedom to demonstrate. And I say, you guys don't get it. There is actually something that exists which is beyond our capacity to understand. There are people out there who live in a death cult. The people, we've known them in the past as ISIS, and we've known them in the past as Boko Haram and all sorts of things like this. These people actually live their lives believing that they're alive in order to die and go to heaven. So anybody who dies in the cause of what they believe in is going to go to heaven, so it's fine for them to die. Now, this is a concept which is beyond our comprehension.
Okay, look, Mark, there's a very important aspect to all of this, and that is by the Israeli government's actions. And I know you're not condoning that at all, but
no,
they're actually likely to create more recruits.
Okay, so and even worse than that, even more insane than that, I agree with you. I'm not going to argue with that. You know, it's a perpetuating vicious circle. I'm not arguing with you about that at all. I wouldn't even begin to. On the other hand, the outpouring of basically hate on Israel right now and spreading out into anti-Semitism is causing the same issue in Israel. So there are lots of people like me in Israel, many more than most people even begin to understand, who seek a just resolution to what's going on, and they want to get out of the West Bank and the occupied territories, even if not thinking about the Palestinians, because they want a future for their children and their grandchildren. And what they're doing now, the world, is we're pushing the Jews back into a space which is familiar and traumatic to them in living memory. Some of the people who were captives as hostages were actually in the Holocaust. And we're saying to the world, well, we're going to put our finger up at the world because none of you care about us anymore. We're going to lose more people who are willing to like move into the space of let's make peace. And the Israelis are going to feel like they're painted in a corner, and they're not going to give a damn about any of the rules of war or what's acceptable or not acceptable, because they see the world doesn't care about
them. Okay, well, what about Zionists over there who've been demonstrating against the government? And many of them are thinking, well, actually, maybe it's just time to get on a plane and get out of here. They're demonstrating against their government, and they're thinking that actually this government is making this an unsafe place to live for Jews.
I agree with you. I think the most extraordinary thing, and many people don't know because we're so overwhelmed with external news, that a lot of what's going on in Israel, and you can either believe me on this or go and read it yourselves, there's plenty of press, is the two extraordinary things happened. The total failure of the Israeli government to move fast on the day of attack. It took them hours to even get the army down there. And secondly, the extreme right-wing behavior and nature of this government, which was incapable. You know, the people, we have people running ministries there who couldn't run a chicken coop. You know, they don't know what they're doing at all.
We've got the same in Bristol, by
the way. Yeah, well, yeah. let me just gather my thoughts again. So the most extraordinary thing we're seeing in Israel now is that the same people and smart kids who were doing the digital court kind of like call out for the demonstrations over the last 40 weeks, demanding that, you know, there's no judicial reform and that we maintain our democracy. They moved into the vacuum created by a lack of ability by the government to function. They were like rabbits in the headlights, so to speak. And there is, you know, within 2 days, 15,000 volunteers had sent up a massive call center in the middle of Tel Aviv, and they have been supporting everything from the families of hospitals to delivering food to helping move people away from, because, you know, in the same way that the Palestinians have been asked to move south in Gaza, and we could get into whether that's even reasonable or possible, you know, 150,000 Israelis have had to leave their homes and move away from the borders, both in the north and the south. Israel and the Israelis right now, and I can feel this in my body because I live there long enough, actually feel in an existential threat to the degree that they feel that the people around them want to wipe them out. And when you look at the charter of the Hamas that calls for that, and you hear the shouts of Iran and their proxy states of Hezbollah, I think it would do the world a great favor if everybody recognized that it's a more sensitive and nuanced situation than they can take it. It's not now, black and white.
You mentioned that you thought it was within human rights law. Let's have a listen now to this controversy that of Keir Starmer, the human rights lawyer and also leader of the Labour Party, talking about whether or not it's actually okay to... and in fact, there's a controversy going on right now with potential calls for his resignation or for him to roll back on whether on his statement that it is okay for the Israelis under international human rights law to deprive the people of Gaza of things like food, water, fuel, medicine.
Just before you put it on,
yeah.
Just before you put it on, I want to reiterate that I think it was a strategically stupid thing for Israel to go in and start bombing away like crazy. I just wanted to get that in there. And the other thing I'd like to mention here is that it's endangering the lives of, I don't want to call them hostages, prisoners, kidnapped people on a level which is kind of, we've kind of forgotten about it, you know. So I just want to make that clear
before
you play.
We've got a couple of things to listen to. This is the one on Keir Starmer. Then we'll have a listen to the what you mentioned, Mark, there, which was the accusations against Gutierrez.
I'm very clear. Israel must have that, does have that right to defend herself, and Hamas bears responsibility.
A siege is appropriate? Cutting off power, cutting off water? Sakir?
Well, I think that Israel does have that right. It is an ongoing situation. Obviously, everything should be done within international law, but I don't want to step away from the sort of core principles that Israel has a right to defend herself and Hamas bears responsibility.
I know that that LBC clip has been widely shared and caused real concern and distress in some Muslim communities. So let me be clear about what I was saying and what I wasn't saying. I was saying Israel had the right to self-defence. And when I said that right, it was that right to self-defence. I was not saying that Israel had the right to cut off water, food, fuel or medicines.
A siege is appropriate? Cutting off power, cutting off water? Sakir?
Well, I think that Israel does have that right.
So he kind of did say it, but then he tried to unsay it. It's a bit awkward, isn't it?
It's complicated because, again, it's nuanced, you know. Again, I'm going to reiterate where I come from. I think both tactically and politically it was a mistake, and we it was a knee-jerk reaction, and the fact that Netanyahu, the first words that came out of his mouth were revenge, shows where his mindset was. And so instead of being statesmanship-like, It was kind of knee-jerk reaction.
Yeah, there seems to be a real lack of statesmen or stateswomen around. Apart from, actually, we're going to hear in a little while from the Queen of Jordan. She's had some interesting things to say about it. Jordanians were, you know, you don't often hear from them. But anyway, let's have a listen before we hear from you again, Mark, to Israel calling on the United Nations chief, Gutierrez, to resign following what he says is a shocking speech.
It is important to also recognize the attacks by Hamas did not happen in a vacuum. The Palestinian people have been subjected to 56 years of suffocating occupation. They have seen their land steadily devoured by settlements and plagued by violence, their economy stifled, their people displaced, and their homes demolished. Their hopes for a political solution to their plight have been vanishing.
Mr. Secretary General, in what world do you live? Definitely, this is not our world. Saturday, October 7, will go down in history as nothing less than a brutal massacre. Saturday, October 7, is a wake-up call for the entire free world. A wake-up call against extremism and terror.
I am shocked by the misrepresentations by some of my statement yesterday in the Security Council, as if I was justifying acts of terror by Hamas. This is false. It was the opposite. In the beginning of my intervention yesterday, I clearly stated, and I quote, I have condemned unequivocally the horrifying and unprecedented 7 October acts of terror by Hamas in Israel. Nothing can justify the deliberate killing, injuring and kidnapping of civilians, or the launching of rockets against civilian targets. End quote. Indeed, I spoke of the grievances of the Palestinian people. And in doing so, I also clearly stated, and I quote, but the grievances of the Palestinian people cannot justify the appalling attacks by Hamas. End quote. And then I went on with my intervention, referring all my positions on all aspects of the Middle East crisis. I believe it was necessary to set the record straight, especially out of respect to the victims and to their families. Thank you.
So that's I think it's Mark Regev, who's the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, and the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, both at the beginning and the end there, with a sandwich in the middle of Mark Regev explaining why he thinks that there was an outrageous comment. So, Mark, let's hear from Martin in a minute, but let's get your immediate reaction as to whether it makes sense to call out what he's saying there, which is effectively is a series of historical facts, surely, about the occupation, which is and the oppression of the Palestinians, which has led up to this. You can't make a speech at the UN without mentioning that, surely.
Okay. Wow, it's amazing. It's amazing. It's so loaded where we're going now that I'm going to step gently, not carefully, but gently. Okay? If nobody, and not me anyway, I can't speak for anybody else, undoubtedly the occupation by Israel of the West Bank. And by the way, they don't occupy Gaza, and we can get into that. You know, we know the prison and the blockade and this and that, but there's also a history behind that, which still in my mind doesn't justify it. But nonetheless, there is a history and a reason to why Israel has kind of put a prison up there and blockaded Gaza for the last, how many is it, 17, 18 years, something like this, 16 years. That is a legitimate, in my opinion, fight of the Palestinian people to push back against the Israelis and say, I have a right to self-determination. The massacre that occurred on the 7th of October is a direct attack on Jewish people for being Jewish. This has nothing to do with our occupation. Otherwise, what is the Holocaust about? What was the reason for the Holocaust? What was the reason for Cossacks going into villages across Russia and Ukraine, what is today Ukraine, over hundreds of years, on a bi-monthly kind of killing, pillaging, raping spree of Jewish ghettos or entire kind of small villages? In other words, the attack on Jews across the world has been in a vacuum all the time, in so much as any appropriate local situation to justify it is used to go out and slaughter Jews. So we have to separate one from the other. If the Hamas had, let's say, just attacked military outposts, okay, and not, you know, gone in there and then raped and killed the girls and the guys in the military outposts, I'd say, you know what? I'm horrified that people died. And children of friends of mine died. But I say this was a military operation opposite a military operation. But they didn't do that. They purposefully went in and perpetuated, according to their charter, the indiscriminate killing, raping, and slaughtering of innocent people from the age of 4 months up to about 19.
Okay, so there are different accounts. That isn't necessarily what happened, is it?
I've seen the pictures. You can see the pictures. 100 journalists saw the pictures. They were wearing GoPro cameras. Let's not even go there.
So they're filming themselves raping.
Yeah. they're filming themselves, and some of them have got recordings. I've heard recordings of them calling up their parents and saying, hey, look what I'm doing, look what I'm doing.
Yeah, because there's also, on the other side, there is also some evidence that the IDF were actually killing hostages as they were trying to so-called charge in and release them from where they were being held.
When now? Over the last few days?
No, this is on the 7th. As hostages were being held in a kibbutz, as one of the ladies phoned up his Israeli radio and said, actually, there were only two of us left. Most of the hostages weren't necessarily, or many of the hostages were killed by the IDF as they tried to liberate us.
Well, first of all, I don't know about that because I haven't heard that specific story, so I can't even comment. But I can tell you categorically, because I have my daughter, who, thank God, wasn't in Israel. She's on the other side of the world somewhere, who would have been at that party, because that's her kind of tribe, and Israel's a small country, and there are only a few festivals a year, so pretty much the same people go to all of them. She lost three friends there, and she has a whole bunch of other people she knows about who were killed, and we have seen the pictures. So let's not... There is too much empirical proof. Now, whether the Israeli army made mistakes and caused other people to die and were, you know, even let's say militarily whatever, they weren't on it.
This is bound to be a problem in any kind of hostage situation.
That's what I'm going to say. Yeah. But that does, but I think linking that to how the Israeli army behaved is, and to the determined and single-minded behavior of the Hamas terrorists going into and killing civilians indiscriminately. And by the way, they killed Israeli Arabs, Palestinian Israeli Arabs. They killed workers from Thailand who were working as carers, and from the Philippines. They were completely indiscriminate. They didn't separate the Jews from the rest and slaughter them and carry them back to Gaza. They just, anything they could see. So I think it's really, we're doing ourselves all a disservice by getting to, did they really do it? Didn't they really do it? Yes, they really did it. Otherwise, I can turn around and say, well, actually, all the pictures we're seeing of Israeli jets bombing Gaza, that's not for real. That's just AI making up a whole bunch of BS. You know, how far do we go down this line? Yeah. You know, it seems to me a pointless conversation.
A lot of this stuff in social media and in the mainstream press gets censored. They say this is just too difficult.
Well, not social media.
Well, some of it. Okay, so you maybe are looking at different
social
media.
You know, by the way, talking about King Hussein's wife, what's her name? I can't remember her first name.
Raina.
Raina, thank you. I kept wanting to say Rina, and I knew it wasn't. Raina, she also got up, in spite of everything she did in the intervention she got on TV, she refused to acknowledge what was there for her to see, and it was sent for them to see, the pictures and the GoPro and the speaking in Arabic and the clear transmissions back to Gaza, because it's really, really not nice to admit that you belong to people who are maybe doing that to other people. In the same way, it's really not nice for me to admit that the Israeli government has been perpetuating an occupation of the West Bank for the last 56 years and allowing settlers to run amok and arbitrarily kill Palestinians in the West Bank. It's not nice for me to acknowledge it.
Well, what seems to be going on is what they call in the military terms a hardening of the sides. So people are being forced to take sides. And the Jordanians have done this largely, I think, due to the... I'm not sure where it was, but one of the Israeli government officials using this map of a greater Israel, which actually included Jordan earlier this year. So saying that this is what the Israelis want to do. They want to actually take over Jordan, expand into Jordan. Now, the Jordanians have been kind of pro-West for many years. They've been kind of part of almost a kind of the NATO bloc alliance, although not officially in NATO, very friendly with the United States, very friendly with Britain. Now they seem to be just saying, well, look, you know, if the Israelis are going to try and take us over, we're going to be much more interested in chatting with the Chinese, the Russians, and the other side. But what I'm trying to say here is a hardening of the sides. It's becoming very difficult for people to be either or not on either one side or the other.
Well, first of all, those of us who can step back enough need to, because we live in a time of crisis, and we've got global climate change coming, and soon we're going to be blaming each other for climate change, and it's going to be even more ridiculous as the storm and the tsunami floods over us. We'll be saying, your fault, my fault, your fault, my fault. That's going to be pretty stupid. If anybody has been, if any of these leaders, like the Jordanian leadership, they must have been following the last 40 weeks of weekly demonstrations against this government. So it's got to be clear to them that this is not the way the, you know, fundamental most of the Israeli population, believes or wants to behave. Okay, they can see that this is not a consensus of the Israeli people. They know that we have an extreme right-wing government. I hear people in the UK calling for proportional representation. You don't know what hell you're getting into with proportional representation.
Well, Martin calls for that regularly. So what? Tell us.
Well, think about it. The Israeli Forum Parliament, Knesset as it's called, is made up of 120 seats. Okay, so you've got to have 61 seats of the Knesset in order to get a majority. You have proportional representation. So let's look at exactly what happened with Netanyahu's party now. I can't remember the numbers exactly, so please don't hold me to them, but I'm just giving an example. He got something like 30-something plus seats. I can't remember if it was 39 or 36, or I really can't remember. Now he's got to make up. He has the biggest majorities. He was the party with the biggest single majority. So the president of the country turns to him and says, please, can you try and form a government? Because that's the way it's laid out in the non-existing constitution, because we don't have a constitution in Israel. Okay? So he turns around and he says, who's willing to get into bed with me so that we can have a ruling, you know, government? He looks around and he ends up with like 10 people who have a party with 10 seats, and another party has, so now he's got 46, and then he finds another party with 5 seats, so he's got 51, and then another 5 seats and he's got 56, and he needs another 4 seats. So he looks around and he sees a bunch of maniacs on the far right who are kind of ultra extremist, messianic, whatever, and says, well, I haven't got any choice. If I want to form a government, I'm going to have to bring them in as well. So here's a party with maybe 2 seats in order to get me across the line who says, if you want me in your government, what I want is 1, 2, 3, 4. So they're going to ask for disproportionate, pledges and commitments. Here's an example in British government. Theresa May, she needed to get things across the line. What did she do? She gave £1 billion to the DUP. She was blackmailed. That's proportional representation.
Martin, can you just respond to that? I mean, Mark's making quite a good point there, that actually it's partly this PR system in Israel that's led to this Netanyahu getting into bed with, well, I mean, he would be probably considered far right himself, but with even more extreme factions in the Knesset.
Well, on the Theresa May, I had to do this, and it wasn't on the PR system, it was in the first-past-the-post system, which, because of the lottery of it, led to the DUP holding the balance of power, because Corbyn did far better than expected and the Tories did far less than expected. I think PR is something that works quite well in countries that are at peace and with a relatively stable political outlook. In other places where it's more tense, It's going to throw up contradictions. And a major contradiction, of course, is that, lots of Palestinians do vote in Israeli elections because they're Israeli citizens, but many of the mainstream parties won't ally with them. And, of course, the West Bankers and the Gazans and the people in the refugee camps in Jordan and Syria, they don't get votes at all. So that's the fact that Israel has a PR system that gives Israelis a voice, it doesn't give them any voice. And that's fundamental to underlying this whole conflict from the 1940s onwards.
Look, one thing that's happened, I was very surprised to hear this yesterday, was the arrest of MP Crispin Blunt, a Conservative MP. And I do wonder whether this is anything to do with the fact that he's been at the forefront of accusing the British government, which he's a member of the same party, that they could potentially be complicit in war crimes. In fact, a letter was sent by him and his group of MPs to Rishi Sunak, saying, "Be careful that you don't by not restraining Israel from committing war crimes, you could become complicit." So let's have a listen to the now arrested, or actually, I think he's been just arrested and then interviewed and then de-arrested. So he's a free man again for a while. And I'll hear from. It'd be interesting to hear from both of you, Mark and Martin, as to number one, whether this could be connected to his statements on human rights in Israel, and number two, whether or not he's right about the war crimes.
International law is pretty straightforward, and the argumentation is laid out in detail in the letter we sent to the Prime Minister, the Foreign Secretary, and the Attorney General. alongside the press notice that explained the situation. And the international law has developed since the end of the Second World War, where through the Rome Statute, and for the lawyers in amongst the audience, it is Article 25 of the Rome Statute that then provides that those people who encourage, aid and abet in that sense, the perpetrators, when you know a crime is going to be committed, share responsibility.
And
so, if every British statement does not contain a request to Israel to act within the limits of international law and spell out what those limits are, which are pretty clear, then we're encouraging Israelis to have a go, and that is a crime. Israel responded to the appalling atrocity of last Saturday proportionately within the ambit of international law, then of course everybody would be supporting Israel. But to respond to one absolutely dreadful crime with another crime, which would be of, in terms of a number of casualties, because there's going to be a greater magnitude, that just makes the whole situation worse, and it's obviously fundamentally wrong.
I mean, the Israelis will say, quite understandably, we have to respond to this. This was a terrorist attack on our territory, just as 9/11 was a terrorist attack on the US. We have to go into Gaza in order to dismantle the terrorist regime that is Hamas. We are having to warn civilians who live in Gaza that we are coming in so that they have a chance to move out of harm's way. And yet you've already, it seems to me, described effectively that warning as a sort of forcible movement of the population.
Well, the scale of the operation that is envisaged means that 1.2 million people are being forcibly, in effect, forcibly transferred out of their homes. And that is a specific offence under the Geneva Conventions. You are simply not allowed to do that. You can't just demand that people just vacate an entire area.
So that's the now arrested, or I don't know if he's been charged yet, I don't think so, MP, Tory MP Crispin Blunt. He's effectively what he's saying there is that the Rome Statute means that any kind of collective punishment, which he says the Israelis are doing to the people of Gaza, the Palestinians, is a war crime, and if the British encourage it, then they are committing a war crime too. So maybe first you, Mark, would you link these statements to the fact that he's just been arrested, or is that just a conspiracy theory too far?
Yeah, that's weird. We're meant to be living in a country of where we have freedom of speech and freedom of expression, and all the time he's not calling out for, like, because of that, I think we should go out and slaughter all the Jews in the street. Then I don't really understand the kind of hysterical.
Could it be
response.
The Jewish lobby or Israeli lobby?
God, I hope not. I mean, that's terrifying to even think of. I think you're giving the Jews way too much power. You're falling into a.
It's a bizarre coincidence, anyway.
It's a bizarre. But we got a bizarre government. Come on, we've got a Home Secretary who's like calling to send, people back to Rwanda, and if they're gay, then we know what's going to happen to them. It's like, let's not even go down that path. We got people, passing laws about demonstrations here that 40 years ago we wouldn't have,
Because someone would say it's just realpolitik. There are factions, there are lobbies out there, and if someone is standing up to them, they're going to find a way to get them, by fair means or foul. And I think quite often nowadays in international politics, I'm not just talking about Britain, those means are foul. If someone is calling you out, then you find a way to take them out. But anyway, what do you make of the rights and wrongs of what he's actually saying?
Well, I want to go back to something really interesting that I looked up today regarding the Nuremberg trials. Okay, sadly, I can't remember the name of the SS officer who this was addressed to. We can find it. I can send it to you. But he was one of the SS officers who was head of what was called the death squads. And the death squads didn't just go out shooting Jews in Europe. They all sorts of intellectuals and Romas and gays and what have you, and all sorts of, in their eyes of the Nazi party, undesirables. And this guy basically was responsible for kind of murdering about a million people, okay? And his defense was, well, I was killing those people, and it's exactly like the British and the Americans were bombing Dresden and killing hundreds of thousands of people in carpet bombing over a week or two, and then the place caught on fire, combustion, what do you call that expression? Anyway, that was his defense in the Nuremberg trials, okay? And the judges who were dealing with this answered him like this. The Nuremberg enforces a fundamental distinction. All civilian lives are equal, but not so all ways of taking them, of taking those civilian lives. The deliberate and purposeful killing of civilians is a crime. Not so the taking of civilian lives that is undesired, unintended, but unavoidable. The errors made by a bomber squadron cannot be deducted from the murders committed by a death squad. It's a difference compounded many times over when those civilian men, women, and children are subjected to torture, rape, and mutilation before their murder. Okay? So in the final analysis, this is the distinction that separates modern civilizations from its predecessors. Now, the idea is really interesting, and I want to make it clear that I'm horrified by what's going on with Gaza. I think we could have done it better. I think
we
should.
They're not errors, aren't they? Bombers are being used over there. They're obviously bombing or sending missiles.
Well, I could show
and
you.
They're not errors. They're hitting the houses. They're hitting the buildings.
No, what they're doing
they
is, and what they were bombing? Saying here in the Nuremberg trial was that when a bomber was trying to hit a factory or a railway line, and if it unfortunately killed civilians around that, it wasn't like they were purposefully trying to kill the civilians. Okay, we're talking about the premeditated action of going in and killing civilians and mutilating them, torturing them, and then killing them, as opposed to the unfortunates. And it's deeply unfortunate, and it's a really hard thing to take on board in your head, and for me it is, well, because I'm a very empathetic guy, and everybody who's dead is dead, and it horrifies me. But the Israelis are categorically, you know, and I'm the first one to criticize the Israelis because I'm a big believer that when we live in a country, it's important for us to call out our country so we can turn it into a better country. You know, I'm kind of a big fan of George Orwell for that here in the UK, and we know how he was loved and hated at the same time for calling out this country time after time. And nobody would ever argue that he was a patriot, just not a nationalist, and I feel like the same thing. So the Israelis, they're going to make mistakes, and they've mostly gone overboard because, you know, you need world opinion in this day and age. And I think the worst thing, even more than all of that, is that what is it doing for the situation of the kidnapped people there?
It seems what you're saying is you don't believe that the war crimes are being committed as.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying.
As Crispin Blunt was saying.
No, I'm not saying that.
Because you've got to let Martin have a go.
Okay, well, can I just add one thing? Because the issue of food and water, totally, I think we should be giving food and water and electricity. There is another issue which can be investigated, and Martin, give me one more second and I'll be quiet.
Okay.
Is that will the Hamas, and based on past experience, the answer is no, but will the Hamas even allow those relief supplies to get to the people who need them? And I think that's a question that needs to be honestly looked at when you consider the behavior of the Hamas.
Martin, do you think they will?
Right, well, I mean, that's just, you know, you've singled out Hamas as a sort of death cult. And of course, there is that aspect to what they are. But of course, as you alluded at the very beginning of your presentation, there's questions in Israel being asked about how much did Netanyahu know about what was being planned. Because in 2019, he spoke to his Likud in the Knesset, and he said we must carry on supporting Hamas and giving them funds, money, and support, because this is the way we're going to frustrate a two-state solution. And he's on the record as saying this.
I agree with you, by the way.
Yeah, well, I'm just trying to find common ground before we perhaps disagree. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And of course, Hamas was originally set up by the Mossad as a means of trying to undermine the PLO and all the rest of it.
Absolutely.
And of course,
true.
There was an election in 2006, I think it was, in Gaza, and Hamas won it. and they would have won the whole Palestinian election, but the Palestinian Authority under Mohammed Abbas was set up by the Western powers and the Israelis, and there was a fight between Hamas and Fatah at that stage, all of which, of course, is grist to the mill of the security state in Israel to see these people fighting each other and so on. But ultimately, Hamas has to be part of any solution, because unless we have another election, but of course they may win that election, just like the Tamil Tigers will probably win any free election in what they call Tamil Elam in northern Sri Lanka, even mm-hmm. though tens of thousands of people were killed in the final put down of their insurrection. I think if you're honest, you will accept that the state of Israel was itself set up by extremely ruthless terrorists who had a very ruthless agenda. They attacked military targets. They killed Lord Moyne, who was the British governor. They killed Bernadotte, who was the UN mediator. They also deliberately went out of their way to kill Palestinian civilians to put the fear of God into them. Now, they didn't get punished, any of those people, at Nuremberg. They got a state out of that. Now, I'm not saying it was right. I think it was wrong. But Hamas have seen all of that, and they're saying to a new generation of young people, and half the people in Gaza are under the age of 16, look how the Israelis got their state. That's how you do it. That's what we're doing. And I don't agree with it. I didn't agree with it. I wasn't around in the 1940s. I don't suppose you were. But, of course, it was fairly common knowledge in Britain at the time about what the Zionist movement was like. And it was actually pretty terroristic by any definition. Now, that doesn't mean that there shouldn't be a state of Israel, but you can see that that birth of the state of Israel as a result of that kind of tactic has created a poisoned atmosphere where those you are opposing are going to say, well, that's what we're going to do. And Yuri Avonry, who's dead now, who was one of the Jewish terrorists, I don't know if you know him, he was one of the Jewish terrorists, and he was always a great voice against Israeli intransigence in his later years.
But Martin, isn't this the way all states are founded? If you go back to the Norman invasion here in Britain, for example.
Well, you could say that, yes. But on the other hand, I think that we've got, you know, we're trying to use language as in as precise and as uninflammatory way as possible. Let's just try and, you know.
What do you make of the arrest of Crispin Blunt? Because I was really shocked to hear, gosh, you know, there's someone saying this about human rights, calling for a ceasefire, this sort of thing, and all of a sudden he's under arrest.
Yeah, but he's, these allegations have been around for a while, Tony. Yeah. Because he said he's already been...
I mean, someone opened the black book. Has someone opened the black book and decided, right, Crispin Blunt, what have we got on him?
Well, you're making that statement, Tony, but I think Mark is right to say that's just going too far, because we don't know. What we do know is that Shai Moffat, I can't remember his name.
Massot, I think.
Yeah. He was caught in a sting by Al Jazeera talking to a Labour MP, Jones, somebody's name I've forgotten. We've got £1 million to spend in the Labour Party to, you know, to put you in a more pro-Israeli direction. And we're going to get rid of Alan Duncan, the Tory minister and foreign, he was a junior foreign minister, because of his pro-Palestinian view.
We're getting off the topic a bit, Martin, but I mean, can you come back to what Crispin Blunt was saying about whether these are war crimes by supporting them, the British government could be complicit.
It's quite clear that you're not allowed to carry out indiscriminate bombing, and you're not allowed to cut off food and water. And the Israelis are on hiding to nothing with this. When the Israeli army goes in, they're going to face a hell of a fight. On the Ukrainian front in Advika or Bakhmut, as the two sides call it, the Russians lost 40,000 and the Ukrainians lost 70,000. That's what modern warfare looks like. And I would suggest that in modern warfare, a tiny state like Israel, surrounded by hostile powers, will find it very difficult to survive unless they start to negotiate. I mean, the Hamas are not very comfortable negotiating. You know, it's not very comfortable for the Israelis to negotiate with them, but they have done it in the past. We've had ceasefires. We've had agreements. The Egyptians have often mediated between Hamas and another.
Well, I mean, Hamas aren't Hamas now. Today. Now Hamas over in hasn't Putin isn't he talking now to Hamas, trying to get some sort of solution? When I heard about that, Martin, yes. Just a second. Yeah, when I heard about that, I suddenly thought of Ken Livingstone bringing the IRA over, and everyone's saying how terrible that was. I'm sure people will be saying it's terrible Putin to talk to Hamas. But let's just get Mark Smullyan's reaction to what you've just been saying there. It'd be interesting to get your take on all this, Mark.
Okay. First of all, I agree with you. A lot of awful stuff happened. If we were to sit down and talk, and I would, you know, I don't have any argument with you regarding the manner in which many, many people behaved prior to the creation of the State of Israel, the Jews there, the extremists, the right-wing people. I could also point out to you other groups of Jews who were living in Israel who were pushing for another way and another way of dealing with it. I could also bring in the British and their responsibility for allowing this to happen because of the Balfour Declaration, and I can go back to the First Zionist Congress where there was a big push between more social left-leaning people and right-wing people, the left-leaning people saying we need to go and live together in this land, and the right-wing people saying, no, we need to go out and carve out our own land. So I think there's great truth in what you're saying, because I have little, well, to sum it up, as my mother said, human beings not the best model. So I don't really have a lot of faith in the kind of behavior that I think, Martin, both you and I and Tony would like to see in the world. I do think there is one subtle, not so subtle difference that we need to look at and acknowledge. I've done a lot of research on this, and apart from the odd nutcase here and there in Israel, and we're hearing a lot of them now, because sadly a lot of them have influence and they're in power, there isn't any kind of proof that Israel has ever said, you know, we want to wipe out all the Palestinian people. There have been silly statements by Golda Meir saying, you know, there's no such thing as the Palestinians. And there have been, you know, denial that these people exist, and we can go on. But of course, if they were living there, whether they were a cohesive group or a bunch of individual little, you know, people living on there, working on their land, they were people there, and that needed to be respected. And paradoxically, of course, because of the conflict in between Israel and the Palestinians, we have given them a self-identity and a name and this and that, which is great. I have no problem with any of that, by the way, because everybody, you know, I'm a humanist. Everybody gets a chance, one quick spin on this extraordinary world we live on, and they should be able to do it in peace and with love and together. And, I'm not justifying anything here from the side of the Israelis, but unlike the PLO, or Fatah as they're now called, who are problematic within themselves, but internally the way they run their country, the issue is that the Hamas are still calling for the destruction of the State of Israel and the eradication of the Jewish people.
Isn't it true that quite a lot of countries around the world still don't recognize Israel?
I don't know how many. I've stopped counting because I find the whole thing completely farcical and ridiculous. You know, it's just like, if you really want to go on, because most of these people throw up these tropes and this rubbish because it's convenient for local politics, you know. I mean, why would anybody say, you know, I don't, you know, if a people exist, the people exist. It's like denying that the Palestinians exist. Why would I deny the Palestinians? Here,
Martin,
you are, you're
so
there.
Martin, maybe you could answer that one. Why would countries around the world say Israel shouldn't exist? Oh, we don't recognize the State of Israel. We have no diplomatic relations with them, for example.
Well, states don't necessarily come in, you know, you're not guaranteed diplomatic representation. We went to war with Serbia over Kosovo. I used to be an aid worker in Yugoslavia, and Spain and various other countries won't recognise Kosovo as independent from Serbia. And, of course, it was an R2P, a responsibility to protect intervention by NATO, which incidentally wasn't supported by the Israeli government because they could see the principle of, intervention, humanitarian intervention being used against them.
Absolutely.
The State of Israel was recognized by main, but because the Soviet Union and the US recognized it, the British abstained. And of course, the Palestinians and the Arabs never accepted it, apart from after the Camp David agreement, the Egyptians accepted it. Now, you don't get guaranteed a recognition as a state. Every state has to win that recognition. The people in Nagorno-Karabakh, Artsakh, as the Armenians call it, I've been there as well. They were booted out recently. And is that a war crime? I'm afraid it is. And the question is, what war crimes are punished and what are not? Anyway, we all know that Tony Blair will never go.
Oh, yeah. Before. Let's have a listen now to the Palestinian and the Israeli representatives themselves at the General Assembly of the United Nations this week, where there was quite an impassioned speech yesterday by, I think it actually knows it Wednesday, by the Palestinian ambassador, and we'll be following that by listening to the Israeli ambassador.
These people you watch in your screens for a few minutes a day, every night, while they are being slaughtered, they have survived decades of military occupation, a 16 years long blockade, and 5 wars in the Gaza Strip. They built and rebuilt and rebuilt their lives and their homes again and again against all odds, despite tremendous suffering. They are walking miracles. How could you leave them to be killed once again? The answer to the killing of Palestinian civilians is not the killing of Israeli civilians. And the answer to the killing of Israeli civilians is not the killing of Palestinian civilians. Vengeance is a dead end. The only path forward is justice. The only path forward is justice. Justice for the Palestinian people. Don't distort the law. Don't bend it. Don't break it. Don't betray it to accommodate Israel. Uphold it, and uphold it high. This is what we are here for as the United Nations, to save future generations from the scourge of war. Uphold it for the sake of all nations, for the credibility of these United Nations. Mr. President, Wael Dahdouh was reporting on the massacres in Gaza. For those of you who do not, who is Wael Dahdouh? He is the field correspondent of Al Jazeera in the Gaza Strip. As he's been doing relentlessly for days now, when he received the news of an Israeli airstrike that killed his wife, his son, and his daughter, he did something many parents do in these circumstances. He spoke to his son, waiting for an answer that never came. He told him, "Didn't you tell me you wanted to be a journalist?" His son wanted to be a journalist, even though journalists are targets in Palestine. Remember Shireen Abu Akleh? Now, the dream of the son will haunt the father. Wael said a few words that I want you to hear well. He said, "They took their vengeance out on our children." He then said in a heartbreaking voice, "Malish, allow me to explain it to you. Literally, it means that's okay. But let me tell you what I believe he meant. Let me do it in Arabic. تُبًّا لِوَاقِعٍ تُقْتَلُ فِيهِ غَزَّةٍ."
What a world where Gaza is being killed again before the cameras of the world. Shame on all those who do not respect our humanity, our dignity, our suffering. all those who justify the act of the killer instead of standing by the victim, to all those who justify the crime and give condolences to the victim and explain that the killer is not responsible for the killing. Shame to all those who do not stand by our people in Gaza and put an end to the massacre. Shame to this forum. If a word of truth is not pronounced on it, shame to the one who will speak after me to defend the wrong and justify the killing of innocent people. There is no justice on this earth. We have God. We have only God to go to.
Finally, I appeal to all of you. Vote to stop the killing. Vote for humanitarian aid to reach those whose very survival depends on it. Vote to stop this madness. You have a chance to do something, to give an important signal. Choose justice, not vengeance. Choose to defend the law, not justify its breach. Choose peace, not more wars. Vote to put an end to two, almost 3 weeks of the worst double standards we have seen in decades. To restore some credibility of this place and the rules it is supposed to embody. Do not miss this chance. Lives are hanging in the balance, and every life is sacred. Please save lives, save lives, save lives. Vote for our draft resolution, and I thank you.
That's the Palestinian ambassador to the United Nations there. Mark, what do you make of his speech there? He's speaking for... not for Hamas. He's speaking for those who are caught up in this and can't escape.
Yeah, it's of course he's going to say all of this, and my heart is in line with let's stop the killing 100%. But there's a massive hypocrisy in there. You know, the Fatah government in Ramallah is interning people in prisons when they stand up against the regime. They haven't had an election there in 30-odd years. They have corruption rife within their government, and they, you know, when it's convenient, they disappear people of their own. So to stand up and to pretend to be this humanist and also not acknowledge, I mean, you're saying we're going to hear the Israeli guy afterwards, so maybe he will, but I think they'll mostly be make the same mistake, not to acknowledge that a bloody great massacre went on beforehand and pretend it's like out of the blue is kind of not going to be helpful to anybody, because if
he may have done it in the early part of his speech. That wasn't the whole thing.
Fair enough. I acknowledge and accept that. I'm willing to. I would lay a fiver on it that he didn't. But you know, maybe I'm wrong.
You're talking about corruption. I mean, Netanyahu, the Israeli system was trying to put him in jail for the last two years.
You're preaching to the converted. Yeah. Listen, I'm in between a stone and three hard places here.
So surely, corrupt Palestine, it cancels out a corrupt Israel.
Yeah,
all these states
listen,
are corrupt.
I think the only light I see in the situation right now is the desperate need to separate the governments and their agendas from the civilians. This is where I'm coming at, and the Israeli people have shown, for those who know, not all of them, over the last nearly 10 months, that they've doing everything in their power to try and change this government and like get rid of this corrupt guy and get him on jail. And there's no doubt in my mind that, you know, he's a bit like Trump.
Well, I think it was Alex Craner, the former hedge fund manager, who said war is the great canceller, because everything you were thinking and talking about before goes because a war has started. And so all of those difficulties that you had before the war are forgotten about in the war. But anyway, look, we'll hear from Martin after we've heard from the Israeli ambassador at the UN General Assembly. Thursday it was, actually, not Wednesday.
Hamas, the terror group that started this war, I reiterate, is not even mentioned, not even once. In fact, the only hidden reference to these barbaric terrorists can be found in calls on both parties. Both parties? This is a false, immoral comparison between the law-abiding democracy of Israel and genocidal jihadists. And the drafters are counting on the fact that each and every distinguished representative here will blindly go along with their ploy. This resolution is an insult to your intelligence, and the only place this resolution belongs is in the dustbin of history. The dustbin of history. But colleagues, this resolution is not the only thing here today that is detached from reality. In a short time, a representative of the evil regime that trained, funded, and armed Hamas for the October 7th massacre will address you. The Ayatollah regime of Iran has the blood of thousands of Israelis on its hands. It has the blood of hundreds of thousands of oppressed Iranians, of Ukrainians, of Americans, of Emiratis, and so many others on its hands. Iran is known as the world's number one state sponsor of terror, and for good reasons. It's completely natural that the foreign minister of this brutal regime should be the speaker following the resolution drafter. The country with a Nazi ideology of annihilating Israel publicly says stands in solidarity with its proxy Hamas, which shares the same Nazi ideology and aims for our destruction. This is completely understandable. Indeed, mere days ago, he spoke with the leaders of Hamas and its twin terror group, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, praising them for the slaughter. And today he is here to fill your ears with poison. Indeed, uniting for peace, uniting to butcher every Israeli to pieces. This man, the mass murderer, or any other representatives of the terror regime in Iran, has no place at the UN, let alone in the family of nations. It is a moral stain on the UN and the values it was founded upon. Distinguished colleagues, this week the UN celebrated its 78th birthday. Yet, looking at this resolution and the honorary guests hosted it today in these halls, this organization has shown that it is so broken, so morally corrupt, that I do not have high hopes that it will make it to 90, let alone 100. I'm just a realist. Today serves as the clearest proof that this body is bleeding its relevance, legitimacy, and justification. What we are witnessing today is a desecration of what the UN was meant to be. Following the horrors of the Holocaust, this institution was established to prevent atrocities from repeating themselves. Yet, in these very halls, we have perpetrators of the most grotesque human rights violations and crimes against humanity who also exploit their power and so-called members of the family of nations only to single out law-abiding democracies such as Israel. If this organization wants to maintain any shred of legitimacy, it is imperative that you, please, distinguished representatives, no longer play along with this farce of anti-Israel double standards. Vote against this biased resolution. Stand on the right side of history. Don't stand with the genocidal jihadists committed to your destruction. Rise above internal political considerations and do what is moral and right. Mr. President, Israel will not stop fighting for the truth, even if we remain the sole voice of reason in these halls. Israel will continue combating the genocidal terrorists committed to our destruction. We will not rest until Hamas is obliterated and our hostages are returned home. And we will bring them home. I will conclude with a moment of silence for all the victims of Hamas's atrocity. If the supporters of this resolution choose to ignore the victims in their text, I will pay respect to their memory.
Well, interesting to see the Israelis accusing Hamas of being Nazis. We just literally weeks ago had the bizarre appearance of a real Nazi in the Canadian Parliament getting applauded. In fact, a standing ovation from all the MPs, including Trudeau, the Prime Minister. And this leads me on to mention a public meeting taking place here in Bristol next Saturday. That is Saturday, the 4th of November, 2023, between 5 and 8 p.m. here at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft. It's organised by No to NATO, No to War, which is the number two, No to NATO, No to War. And so that is going to be featuring Warren Thornton, who was a journalist who was arrested for malinformation over exposing Trudeau applauding the Nazi Waffen-SS member. So what Warren did was actually track this guy, the specific individual, down and the unit down. So also speaking at that meeting is myself, Tony Gosling, journalist, Chris Williamson, former Labour MP for Derby and former leader of Derby City Council. James Tweedy, also a journalist who we had on this show last week. And Dr. Judith Brown. Judith is a regular, appears regularly on here. Martin Summers is also going to be speaking, as is Konrad Rekas, who's a Polish journalist, all at this meeting, Saturday, 4th of November, 5 p.m. till 8 p.m. here at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, Bristol. So, Martin, that was yesterday, the Israeli ambassador at the United Nations General Assembly discussion. They're due to vote any time now, actually, on that resolution.
Well, I think perhaps the best way to approach this is to try and approach it from a kind of political science point of view, rather than me making a case for what I believe. Let's just talk about what might happen. The Hamas cannot be written out of a political solution. That's the clear message I'm getting from the Israeli ambassador there. He's equating Hamas with ISIS. Now, it's interesting that he should they should do that, is because ISIS in Syria was helped by the Israeli army. The jihadis who were fighting the Syrian Arab army, which is a secular army, they were coming back into Israel via the Golan Heights, which we haven't talked about at all, which were seized from Syria in 1967. I think the issue for Israelis of any stripe, really, is that if you keep betting the farm, as you continually do, you've written off the right wing in Israel have written off a two-state solution. That means we're going back to a one-state solution. Or don't forget there's a world war breaking out between Russia, China and the West. States can disappear. Kosovo was made independent, but the Serbs in Krajina, and I drove through the Krajina after, they were all ethnically cleansed by the Croatians with full support of NATO.
Martin, he's bringing in Iran particularly there, saying Iran is behind
Iran
this.
Iran is not helpful. Iran is not particularly the sort of regime I would want to live under. But on the other hand, they do have elections, unlike Saudi Arabia, for example. Our glorious allies, who we supply with loads of weaponry, keeps everybody in Filton in Christmas money. And yet when's the next election in Saudi Arabia? Don't ask. But we've helped them to support them in the invasion of Yemen, which is an independent country that does have elections. But we're not interested in that. I think that the hypocrisy is all round. You know, the Palestinian person talking earlier, he was playing on the heartstrings. Yeah, it was a rhetorical strategy to make everybody feel more sorry for them and all the rest of it. I know why they do it, but it's still, you know, we're trying to be objective here. And I think what may happen here is that there isn't really a military solution for either side. There just isn't. And what would have happened in the past and has happened in the past, is you have a ceasefire and then you negotiate hostage release. I understand that what Hamas are saying is that 50 of the hostages are already dead because they've been killed by Israeli bombing. Now, in the past, that didn't happen because Hamas captured a couple of soldiers many years ago now, 20 years ago now, and there was a load of discussion, and eventually they were released, and Palestinian prisoners were released, because loads of people are being held in Israeli prisons without trial, basically administrative detention.
Yeah, well, Martin, you say there's going to be no sort of battlefield solution. There will, though, have to be a political solution. What do you make of that Hamas leader's visit to Moscow? He's there right now.
For example, if the Israelis want to delegitimize Hamas and they say that nobody's talking to them, well, they're in Moscow today. But don't forget, we don't talk to Moscow. Moscow is about to have an election in March, presidential election, and Putin will win. He's going to get 80%.
Yeah, but the Foreign Office is saying here, look, is an axis of terror is forming.
Well, yes. Well, I mean, this isn't helpful, is it? It's actually quite complicated. Middle Eastern politics are really complicated. You've got the Sunni Shia split. You've got splits between different groups on all sides. You've got the manipulation by the Israeli and Western deep state of all of these Islamist terrorist groups. If you'd watched the film Charlie Wilson's War, it's a secret line of weaponry being supplied to jihadi terrorists in Afghanistan to kill Soviet soldiers. And a lot of the weaponry that was supplied to them was weaponry that, and there's a scene in the film where they go and talk to the Mossad, and the Mossad say, well, we've got loads and loads of Soviet weaponry captured in 1973, and you can have it all. And then you can give it to the jihadis who were fighting the Soviets. And then, of course, they came and blew up the Twin Towers, except there's loads of questions about that. Loads of questions.
All right. Anyway, Mark.
So in other words, let's try and avoid getting into, the emotional rhetoric, and let's just talk about what is likely to happen from a realpolitik point of view. And realpolitik isn't machtpolitik, power politics. Realpolitik just means being realistic. You can't write Hamas are going to have to be part of some kind of political solution. It's very hard for the Israelis to swallow, but then it's very hard for the Palestinians to swallow that the Israelis set up a state in the first place. Because it wasn't actually a unanimous decision to set it up.
Yeah.
Fighting the Israeli terrorists didn't want it. Ernie Bevin, who came from Bristol, was opposed, but he was overruled.
Let's just let Mark respond to that and also wind up.
Yeah, I think Martin, there's, being pragmatic is the way I've kind of looked at the world. It feeds into my emotional worldview anyway of like, each one of us gets, as I said earlier, a quick spin on this amazing planet, and that's it, and everybody should have...
There's something crucial here, which is the Israeli government is saying they're going to exterminate Hamas. Martin is saying they have to be part of some sort of political solution. You know, it's impossible because, and as I said earlier on, what's happening is more people are being recruited to Hamas by this carpet bombing. Well, it's not carpet bombing, it's precision bombing, but many people are being, innocent people are being killed, and those Palestinians are thinking to themselves, well, why am I standing here being killed? I better join some fighting force, in this situation. So anyway, just if you could just address that.
Yeah, okay. There is a kind of a... in the past, we've made agreements with Hamas, and Martin, I agree with you. What's been convenient at the time, Netanyahu, dividing between Fatah and the Hamas in order to make sure there couldn't be a two-state solution or no solution. I accept all of that, and I think it's... clear to anybody with even the most limited understanding. I think there is a major problem in so much as the Hamas, declares it wants the destruction of the state of Israel, and knowing what kind of what drives jihadi thinking, I think it's more realistic to accept that they do want that as opposed to it just being rhetorical talk. I think, yes, in the end, they're going to have to work opposite some representatives of what we call the Hamas now, the Qataris or whatever it is. But I do think that the Israelis are going to do everything they can to impose a different kind of rule on Gaza. And I would just very quickly like to reflect on something. I've been against both the kind of the prisonization and the blockade of Gaza, but not for the reasons that many people think. You know, in 2007, the Hamas were elected into power. They weren't recognized by America and Israel. Israel claims they didn't recognize it because they were calling for the destruction of the state of Israel, and America kind of went along to back them up. But they, when they got the government of Gaza, we didn't see them really trying to build Gaza or create an infrastructure or anything like that. We did see them categorically taking the monies and developing weapons and tunnels and pushing back and firing rockets into Israel quite regularly. I mean, I can remember it myself. And I think that when that happened, there was a certain legitimacy in Israel, and Israel had the right to say, wait a minute, you know, you're by yourselves there now, why are you firing rockets at us? And then it blossomed out of control, and I think there's a whole debate in there. They won't speak directly to the Hamas. They will speak to them through covert, under, you know, background channels. But I don't think they're going to allow the Hamas to stay there. And I think they're going to demand that the world put other forces in there to try to rebuild the place. I am terrified for the prisoners there. I don't know, you know, they're kidnapped. They're not hostages. They're kidnapped people. Because I think that, you know, they've kind of been put on the back burner, and I'm terrified that the Israeli government is willing to sacrifice them for their bigger picture. And we need to remember something else, which is, you know, being pragmatic, as you said, which is that we got a prime minister who, in my opinion, and this is just me, Mark, so nobody come and scream and shout at me and put a bullet in my head, in my opinion, he's delusional in the same way that kind of Trump is delusional, and Orban in Hungary are these kind of delusional, and Erdogan and all these crazies around the world. Putin, of course. And
Biden?
Biden, I don't think he's delusional. I think he's a bit old.
Yeah, he doesn't know what's going on.
Well, I think he's, you know, the American economy is pumping up better than it has been for a while. So, but anyway, I mean, but you know, you toss a coin, you want Biden or Trump. I'll go for Biden either way. You know, I'd like to get rid of both of them.
I think we've got almost universal swivel-eyed leaders around the planet.
Yeah, well, you know, we've got a real bad level of leadership in general around the world. It's not great. And the few who were quite good are like getting out really fast, if it's like Jacinda in New Zealand or, you know, I'm not quite sure what I think of, what was her name from the SNP?
Nicola Sturgeon.
You know, but she got into that whole scandal, but at least she presented a kind of seemingly normal. You know, Angela Merkel's gone home because she's exhausted. She was one of the better ones. But, you know, people could argue with me on that. I'm just talking about maintaining a balance on the world stage of some kind of normality.
It's a mega dysfunctional, it seems to me.
Yeah, and
by the way, so I don't want to interrupt you, we're just hearing today on France 24, the displaced Gazans are now heading back north after finding the south no safer when Israel warned civilians to leave northern Gaza. Rama Sakala and her family fled south, but after Israeli bombs killed her husband and three of her children in the south, she's now heading back home.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's just so ridiculous. I mean, if it wasn't so tragic, it would be boring as all hell. It's like a bunch of people screaming and shouting about my playground, your playground, my sandpit, your sandpit. But of course, that is so like kind of like lighthearted because people are dying.
But slowly, surely, it seems to be turning into almost a religious war, you know.
It used to be a nationalistic war, now it's turning into a religious war, and what's happening in the West Bank is absolutely appalling. But I'll tell you what, I want to sum up with something else altogether, and we could carry on talking. Martin, it's been a privilege and a pleasure because you've said some really insightful stuff, and I really respect and support much of what you're saying. I'm actually more scared about this old trope linkage of like when something happens in Israel to the Jews, all of a sudden, or something happens between Israel and the Palestinians or any kind of local Middle East conflicts, all of a sudden anti-Semitism raises its head and all of a sudden here I am, me, Mark, in England, and I'm to blame. And my daughter said to me for the first time ever in her life, you know, Dad, I'm scared. I never thought I'd be scared. I'm just like, you know, doing my thing and having a life and all of a sudden I'm scared. And I think what we need to be doing in the UK is looking internally, not ignoring what's going on there, but saying, hey, wait a minute, we got to take care of what's going on here, because I am not hearing enough non-political voices standing up and saying, regardless of what's happening in Israel, what we're doing here is dangerous, insidious, and falling back into the same old anti-Semitic tropes. The fact that the fact that, you know, kids are getting scared to go down the street wearing, you know, school uniforms with a Star of David on it, or the pictures of the hostages, the kidnapped people in that they put up in London, all being mutilated and with pictures of like little Hitler mustachios on their noses and all sorts of awful stuff, and a Jewish bakery or butcher or whatever it was, you know, nearly pulled to, you know, almost burnt to the ground the other day, and all sorts of awful stuff. And I am not hearing enough pushback from within the UK community across the board, just by people saying, wait a minute, he's not to blame, you're not to blame for what's going on in Israel. Otherwise, like I said at the beginning, everybody's to blame for everything. A Nigerian third generation UK guy is responsible for atrocities going on in Nigeria, the same for India or anything else. So,
well, I'd like to think that Britain is not a country where people do think like that. I think, you know, really?
There's a 650% peak in anti-Semitic occurrences over the last 3 weeks.
Is that, what about Islamophobia, no?
Absolutely. I'm not comparing. Let's not do this. I'm not saying, same thing. If when the Muslims are attacked because 9/11 happened, I'm the first one standing in line saying, hey, don't call out these people for that. I'm not, it's not acceptable across the board. It's not because I'm Jewish. I'm saying we consider ourselves an open-minded kind of liberal, whatever. I know we've got our fringes on the left and on the right, and we're dealing with that, and we're seeing it coming more and more into the center stage, and it's scary as all hell, for many of us. But I'm not seeing enough, other than a bit of radio reporting and saying, oh, that's awful, let's talk about Islamophobia when it happens. You know, that's it. And then we pass on to, you know, get a cheap washing material or like some advert after it, which makes the whole thing null and void. The community in England, Britain, is being allowed to have to do this linkage between what's going on in the Middle East, between Israel and the Palestinians, the Hamas, and the Jews in the UK. I have many, many friends and family who are scared to go out of their houses now. Mm-hmm. And the people need to recognize that in living memory was a trauma where 6 million people were burnt, gassed in ovens, and they have every reason to believe that it could happen again. And they live in fear. They live with trauma, PTSD, and they need to be not just supported and told they're all right, but empowered to come out and participate in the general dialogue of what we are as Britons.
Yeah, well, good sentiment to finish on, Mark Smullyan, and thanks ever so much for joining us. We're going to listen now to a guy called Amir Whiteman. He's in the Likud party. He was on RT earlier this week, and we'll hear what Martin's got to say about his little performance on RT. After we've heard from Amir Whiteman, Artie's band over here, and it's, in a way, it really amazed me to see this clip because it's a very fiery exchange.
Why is it then that this bombing has been condemned and accused? The president of Egypt, the king of Jordan, the president of Syria, the president of Cuba, the government of Iraq, the Turkish foreign minister, the Venezuelan foreign ministry, the head of the African Union, and the president of Iran have all accused Israel of this strike. And you're telling me, the strike never happened? It never happened, Mr. Weidman. It's all a lie. It's all smoke and mirrors, right?
Listen, all the countries you have mentioned, all of them are terrorist countries. Syria,
oh, they're all terrorist countries. Jordan, an American ally, is a terrorist country. Turkey, Venezuela, the African Union.
Freaking people in his country under Russian support. He's a murderer. He's a mass murderer who should be hanged in public like the Nazis have been hanged in public. The fact that these people are the people saying that this has happened exactly shows my point. And if you are not able to understand that, and I get, with all due respect, that I understand you are under Russian payroll, and I understand this is a Russian propaganda, but you have to be very careful, because let me tell you, we're going to finish this war. We're going to win because we're stronger. After this, Russia will pay the price. Believe me, Russia will pay the price. Russia is supporting the enemies of Israel. Russia is supporting Nazi people who want to commit genocide on us, and just Russia will pay the price. Russia also. Now, listen to me very carefully. We are going to finish with these Nazis. We're going to win this war. It's going to take the time it's going to take, but we're going to win this war. Afterwards, we're not forgetting what you are doing. We're not forgetting. We will come. We will make sure that Ukraine wins. We will make sure that you pay the price for what you have done. You as Russia, and you and as all the enemies of Israel, and you as all the people who are now making everything they can to support genocide of the Jews in Israel. We are not forgetting. We are not forgetting. Remember exactly what I'm saying now. You will pay the price.
Amir, I think it's safe to say that this is a very passionate conflict that is happening here.
Well, people have been massacred. My people has been slaughtered by your proxies, and you will pay the price. Is it clear? Believe me, you will regret this day.
No, I don't actually think it is clear.
Very, very, very sternly.
I don't think it is clear, Mr. Weipman, and I think, and I would suggest,
then it should be
in the
clear,
future,
it should be clear,
as being a politician,
it should be clear to you, because you have to understand that actions have got consequences. And when people support murder of Jews, people pay the price. This is true in Gaza. This is true everywhere else. The time that Jews actually have no power to defend themselves is done, is gone. And people will now have to bear the consequences of them supporting genocidal Nazis who are out to exterminate Jews. What we have seen 10 days ago is not something normal. We have seen these Nazis going out, massacring people in the streets, babies, beheading them, older people, women, raping, all these things. You've seen them with your eyes. How can you even dare to support the murderers? I tell you frankly, the public opinion in Israel has changed. We are not now where we were 10 days ago. You have to understand that.
So, I think fascinating interview. There's a longer version I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk with Amir Weipman. Martin, what do you make of that?
Well, it was a pretty bad-tempered exchange, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, he's saying basically once we finish with Hamas, we're coming for Russia.
Well, it's delusionary. I don't think that militarily Israel used to have the upper hand. That's no longer necessarily the case. And don't forget, there's been a war going on in Syria since 2012 in which Israel has played a significant role, as have Britain. Where are the white helmets? Why aren't the white helmets in Gaza, you know, rescuing the people that are under these indiscriminate bombings? And the war has been going on. You know, it's come to Israel with a bang in the last week or so, but it's been going on since 9/11 and before 9/11. And people live in a consumerist daze where it's something happening on television, and then suddenly it comes home to them, no, it's not just television, this could be me. And of course, the Israeli Likud guy there is expressing the rage and frustration of the Israelis about the fact that they're not going to win this war. It could end up with a situation. We were talking earlier with Martin.
Mark.
The state of Israel was created within boundaries in 1948, which are much, much smaller than the current state of Israel. We reached a passage of play where the Oslo Accords and the Camp David Agreement, where they were going to be allowed to keep everything they've captured since 1967, apart from the Golan Heights, which is still...
Yeah, when a Netanyahu supporter assassinated the president. Anyway, yes. So look, I want to go up to another level, because I think that was such an interesting interview. Really, you could say, I mean, you could say the guy's unhinged, you could say he's crazy, but this is a sort of rhetorical technique he's using here by being so extreme, by threatening, you know, to attack Russia. I mean, that potentially could mean with Israel's nuclear weapons. What he's doing is he's trying to seize the initiative. It's almost like a game. You know, the more extreme you can be, the more the opposition or those that are listening have to, sort of react to him. He's trying to seize, it's almost like a chess game. We are going to say something and do something really crazy, so you have to react to that. And constantly it's us that's got the initiative.
Well, I think it was very unwise of him to come out with that rant, frankly. What they need at this moment, the Israelis, is to maximise international support. And they're not going to do it.
Well, they don't care about that, do they? They're not very really interested. In fact, what they're doing is they're hardening the sides, as I was saying earlier. They're now saying, there's the Iranians and the Russians, and we're with the Americans. We're getting ready for a war.
What they could do here is they could lose the state of Israel at the end of World War III, which is going to happen very soon. At the end of it, the state of Israel may be gone, and many people who live in Israel now will flee. They'll go.
Well, there were some taking off already. Anyway, look, on this subject of Israeli nuclear weapons.
French settlers in Algeria, they've been living in Algeria for 123
years. Yes, and then they had to go. The same may happen in Israel. So on this subject of Israeli nuclear weapons, I know.
But you can see that it's definitely becoming possible.
On the subject of Israeli nuclear weapons, Martin, can I just pick up on that? This was an interview done on Australian news with an Israeli politician where the Australian journalist obviously bounced this question in on him. Mostly these Israelis will not do interviews if there is any, unless all the sort of questions have been agreed beforehand for people that don't know. And it seems obvious to me watching this that this was not one of those questions agreed, and he bounced this question at him.
Why should the world tolerate you having nuclear weapons and not, say, Iran?
First, again, we never admitted to have such a weapons, but the very comparison is, I must say, it's very insulting, and I tell you why. We suffered one Holocaust. We listened to our neighbors.
Is it because of the Holocaust that you should be allowed to have nuclear weapons?
You know what? This interview was finished now. Your attitude is so hostile, and your questions are so arrogant, I don't want to...
That's it. Kind of winds up the interview at that point. But it's a question that the Israeli CIA don't want to answer, and they seem to be in denial about it.
If they answered it honestly, the Logan Act in the US, it means that any country that's got nuclear weapons outside the agreed system, sanctions come in automatically. So they want the world to know they've got nuclear weapons, but they don't want to officially admit it, because if a government spokesman like that officially admits it, then legal processes start to come in to put in sanctions on Israel.
Now, I want to look at something else, which is the enormous media pro-Israeli. I mean, listening to the Rupert Murdoch talk radio and reading some of the Rupert Murdoch press, like The Sun, etc., is incredibly pro-Israel, despite the massive, massive inequality. Well, it's the kill ratio, you could call it. Something like 5 or 6 to 1, at least at the moment. 5 or 6 Palestinians being killed for every Israeli, which is a very brutal way to look at it. But the ratio is going higher and higher all the time. Very few Israelis being killed, many Palestinians being killed right now. And what with this? Well, I think it was in it Tuesday evening or Monday night. 700 Palestinians being killed in bombing in one night, and possibly no Hamas fighters down in their tunnels or whatever. But anyway, let's have a listen now to I'm not sure the guy's name, but he's an American celebrity who was. He explains here he was being paid, or they offered to pay for him to go to Israel. But then he found out when he landed that there was a bit of a quid pro quo.
Steve Byrne calls me, and Steve Byrne goes, "You want to go to Israel?" I go, "Why?" That's my response, right? He goes, "It's free. They'll fly you out."
You come on. You didn't do Birthright and pretended you were Jewish.
No.
Can you imagine?
Yeah, I didn't do that. No, but he said, the government, Israeli government, is flying out like celebrities for free out there to do a tour for free, and it's on the house. They fly you first class, the whole thing.
Wow.
And I go, "Oh, who's going?" He goes, "It's going to be me, you, George Lopez, Jamie Chung, Brian Greenberg, her husband."
I like it. I love him.
I love Brian, right? And I go, "It's free?" And he goes, "Yeah, it's not free. Because when you land there, they go, you have to every day tweet positive things
About Israel. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I just felt so uneasy about it.
Yeah, but couldn't you just go, why do you, because you have a lot of Palestinian friends?
Yeah, I mean, I know some, you know what I mean? I don't know much about it. I just know that they're in conflict, and it's just like, but I did what they said, but it's like the wrath I got
was insane.
Insane.
What was some of the stuff you tweeted? Jews good, Palestinians bad.
Yeah.
Is that what you tweeted?
Yeah. Jew number one.
Build the wall higher.
It was just basically, you know, Israel's a beautiful country.
Yeah, that's probably true. That's true.
It is true, but then it's like I had to tag the government in it or whatever.
Oh, that's crazy. The Israeli government?
Yeah.
Oh, that's weird as shit.
Yeah, and it was just like day it was just nonstop.
You were cucking for the Israeli government.
Yeah, but I wish I hadn't gone really.
So there's this is before the conflict, but as the conflicts unfolded, there are various mostly Americans, and I think a Brit we're going to hear from in a minute, who are saying that they've been directly approached with money to do pro. This is influencers, TikTokers, and people like that to do pro-Israeli videos. So that may be a temptation for some people just to take some money and say, "Hey, Israel's great."
Did you know that Israel is paying influencers on social media $1,000 a video to put out reports about Hamas being evil and savage and beheading babies and defending Israel's right to defend themselves in this genocide? $1,000 a video. They're paying influencers to promote their genocide. First of all, shame on any of you influencers who took the bait and the money and did this. Shame on you. You are complicit in the genocide of a people. Second of all, shame on Israel. You know what? I would expect nothing less, since you're just a vassal state of the United States who does the same thing. It's always about controlling the narrative, and it's always about putting your propaganda out there to justify the horrific things you do to other people in the world. Just like the United States does. It's disgusting. And as a United States citizen, I'm going to continue to fight against my own country doing it. And I'm going to continue to fight against Israel doing it. This is horrific. It is time for anybody with a platform to come together and demand that the United States stops funding Israel to the tune of $3.3 billion a year. The United States is enabling this. And has been the entire time. It is time to end this. It is time for us as decent Americans to call not only our own country out for enabling this genocide, but call out Israel for performing this genocide.
I have and always will fully support Palestine. And I just felt the need to put that out there because a brand really tried to pay me to change my opinion today. That's not going to happen. You cannot buy my morals. I had a brand deal lined up with this particular brand. I've even filmed the video and everything. Today was the day I was meant to post it. Today I also posted on my Instagram loads of pictures from the Palestine protest in London, right? I messaged them. I'm like, am I still going to post the video at this time? They said no. Then I received a essay basically saying that they're not willing to work with me anymore because I've publicly said that I support Palestine. I was like, that's fine, because I as much don't want to work with you if you support innocent people dying. Oh, sorry, I dashed my remote onto the floor. And then I thought it was over. It wasn't. I then received another message where they said if I take the post down and publicly announce that I do not support, that they will pay me basically double the amount that we agreed on, and they would repost my video onto their feed, which obviously has fucking loads of followers. I am so... In what actual right mind do you think that you can buy my morals? They really wanted me to come online and be like, yeah, I'm actually okay with these innocent people, just these innocent children as well. Just so you all know, I support Palestine. If you want to unfollow me because of this, that's fine. If other brands don't want to work with me because of this, that's also okay. There's quite clearly bigger problems in the world. We're discussing them right now.
Interesting. That was Kara Watzka from the UK. I'm not sure the guy was before, but Martin, it looks as if there's actually quite a lot of money in this for people if they want to, I suppose hide the fact. I mean, you could call it bribery. Why not? Hide the fact that they're being paid, but they're going out there using their platform that they've built for themselves in order to support the Israelis.
Well, the Israeli deep state, as was pointed out, it's got $3.5 billion per year to play with. They take this, what they would call cyber warfare, very seriously. You know, there's many, you know, the Israeli, what's the name of the app that they were selling around the world to spy on activists? I've forgotten. Pegasus. Yeah. And this, they take this all very seriously.
It's like, yeah, it's psychological warfare. This is an important part of war fighting.
Right. So, I mean, you don't forget that even standard mainstream journalists are paid to do what they do. and they're paid to do what they do because they don't step too far out.
Well, I mean, on that very topic, I spoke to our old friend Kevin Cahill earlier this week about this, and we'll be hearing about his thoughts about the Gaza bombing in a minute. But here he is explaining to me some of the motivations behind Rupert Murdoch and the way he covers certain issues.
If this money is Rupert Murdoch is there, so you can assume there is money in this. The Murdoch empire and its media are doing this for money. So they have decided that the money is there if you support genocide. So they are benefiting. Overwhelmingly, the only reason Rupert Murdoch does anything is for money. He backs people who will make him money. He criticizes people who don't. And his media are actually totally corrupt. And it is he has corrupted them. I had a conversation with the Metropolitan Police a while back. The High Court order on the Devon and Cornwall Police was also made on the Metropolitan Police. And the conversation I had was about the News of the World. The News of the World was a blackmail operation. And I told, eventually, I couldn't tell it at the time, I passed on the information I had on the News of the World, that it was acting as a blackmail operation against mainly Parliament. But the big money was being authorised out of the News of the World by Murdoch personally. And the payments were being made to the Metropolitan Police. Murdoch, for years, bribed, corrupted, and completely undermined the Metropolitan Police. And he got away with it. Remember that farce in Parliament when somebody hit him with a bun or something? But Murdoch got away with it. The Metropolitan Police were grossly at fault for failing to prosecute Murdoch for bribing the Met. That's what he did. And one of the reasons the Met is in the disarray it is in is because Murdoch undermined it and corrupted it.
Well, Kevin should know, he worked for Rupert Murdoch in the early 1990s for the Sunday Times on the Rich List. And I'll put the full version of that interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. He's spelling it out, Martin. It's almost certain that there is money coming from somewhere to support the Israeli cause.
Well, the Israeli state has got official money that it spends, and they've got a big slush fund. Because just like the Western intelligence services, they're very involved in things like the drugs trade. So there's a massive amount of money floating around to steer public opinion in this direction or that direction.
Okay, let's just hear what Kevin's got to say about the Gaza bombing anyway.
International law is very clear. You can't mass murder civilians, even if you're claim to be doing a military operation. The operation in Gaza right now is mass murder. Yes, Hamas hit Israel and killed 1,400 people. That is dreadful. But that is not an excuse for bombing Gaza, starving it, and so on. Bombing Gaza and starving it is a crime in international law. There is a very big body of this, what you might call good Israelis who don't support any of this because there is no way forward. You cannot murder every Palestinian in Gaza. That's not a solution. But there's something even more important. As a former soldier, there is no chance of a ground invasion of Gaza happening while there are hostages. Hamas has got Israel in a vice. Any attack on Gaza will have terrible casualties in the Israeli army. They will lose between 2,000 and 6,000 troops. They will lose 30 or 40 tanks, and they won't achieve their aim. If their aim is to destroy Hamas, they'll have to kill every Palestinian in Gaza, which is roughly what they're trying to do. And it won't work.
So that's Kevin Cahill there explaining some of the, I mean, because he actually was in the British Army fighting out in Yemen as well, Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think he's right that they can't win. I mean, as you see, the ground assault hasn't gone in because they just don't know how to get it in there.
Well, they've been going in at the night time. It's almost as if they're provoking. I mean, going as absolutely far as they possibly can without getting Hezbollah to intervene, because Hezbollah have said they will if they go in. But so they've been sneaking in at night and sneaking back again.
Yeah, well, from what Douglas McGregor has been saying, who's a former US lieutenant colonel who fought in the Iraq war, tank commander, he's saying, well, they've gone in and US special forces have gone in with them. Presumably that can imply that British special forces went in with them and Hamas chewed them to bits because this is the war they want to fight.
Anyway,
ruthless of Hamas.
Our final piece on this tonight will be someone I spoke to yesterday is the former MP in South Africa for the ANC, Jewish MP, Andrew Feinstein, who's been a campaigner for human rights across the world and also author of a book all about the global arms trade and how much of that fuels much of what we're seeing today. I mean, we can sometimes forget about the financial incentives of all these bombs dropping and killing people and destroying buildings, etc., and the global arms trade that's behind it. So let's have a listen now to him. I asked him particularly about this idea of the demonstrators, the Zionist demonstrators actually out in Tel Aviv, many of whom have been chanting and trying to campaign because they see Netanyahu and the far right bloc, the Greater Israel bloc that's now in charge over there, destroying their Zionist dream.
You've actually got tens of thousands of Zionists challenging Netanyahu and saying, actually, you're destroying our dream of a Jewish homeland in Israel. And the people they're directing this against is this new political far-right Greater Israel political bloc.
Yeah. So what I would recommend is that anybody who's really interested in this stuff, because it is fairly nuanced and complex, I've done a series of Double Down News that are available online. That people should listen to, because this Israeli government is, you know, avowedly and proudly fascist in nature. It is deeply racist. It is deeply undemocratic. And you're exactly right where you started off, that the main reason for the judicial reforms in Israel are because Netanyahu himself personally is facing all sorts of criminal investigations. And in addition to the three counts of fraud, you know, there are numerous counts of other far more major corruption, including involving a number of vast arms deals, where in one case, for instance, Netanyahu's own official legal advisor, who also happens to be his cousin, was actually used as the agent by the defense company that was paying the bribes to politicians, military officials, and others in Israel. So, you know, these judicial reforms are like Berlusconi in Italy, like Trump in the United States of America, like Orban in Hungary, et cetera, are, again, these sort of ethno-nationalist leaders who are trying to undermine the basic rule of law in their own countries in order to protect themselves from prosecution. And Netanyahu's doing exactly the same. The one thing I think we should say is, you know, Israel has never been, although some people would claim this, a shining light of democracy. It has been a democracy only for a tiny segment of the population. It has never been a democracy for Palestinian Israelis. And of course, it hasn't been anything like a democracy for Palestinians who live under a brutal and illegal occupation. And we need to understand that this is a criminal fascist government in power in Israel at the moment. You know, we have a minister of security who is responsible for policing the occupied Palestinian territories, who, I mean, has actually been accused of terrorism. He's actually been convicted of certain hate crimes within Israel itself. Some people partly blame him for the assassination of the late Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, for certain things that he said in the lead up to the assassination. This is a man who lives on an illegal settlement in occupied Hebron, who has a pick picture of a chap called Baruch Goldstein in his house. And Baruch Goldstein was this Jewish supremacist who shot dead more than 20 innocent Palestinians, and who someone like Ben-Gavir absolutely venerates. So, you know, we must be absolutely clear about the nature of this government. And what is so interesting is that there are people in civil society, there are ordinary people in Israel who are turning against this fascist government. And they're doing it for different reasons. You know, some of them are doing it because they believe that Netanyahu has shown himself incapable of defending Israeli lives. Others are doing it because they think the extreme nature of what is clearly just vengeful revenge that is being perpetrated against all Palestinians in a form of collective punishment that is a war crime. There are some Israelis who find this reprehensible and repulsive. And it's why, again, you know, the sort of notions that are projected in our media of Israel as one unified society, or as Jews who are all of one mind about all of these things, is such absolute nonsense. There are complexities and nuances to the situation that we have to understand. But then, while there are complexities, there are also things about it that are incredibly simple. And that is that the Palestinian people, since the Nakba, have been under the most appalling and brutal occupation known in history. And I grew up in apartheid South Africa, so I know about this sort of racist oppression. And that the sort of reaction from Israel to Hamas's action, and I greatly deplore the loss of innocent lives in the Hamas action, but I can also understand how, like in apartheid South Africa, brutal violence by the state beget awful violence by those seeking liberation and freedom. But that the nature of the Israeli response is completely out of order, and that our political leaders, that our media cannot outrightly condemn what is going on in Palestine, what Israel is perpetrating, is perhaps the greatest failure of courage and conscience that I have seen since the heyday of apartheid South Africa.
Well, look, a lot of people are framing this as a Islamic Jewish conflict, a religious conflict. Would you agree?
That's an absolute nonsense. You know, that is the sort of, it's the sort of Manichean worldview of everything can be defined as either good or evil. There is no nuance, there is no complexity. And, you know, just as we have been speaking about the fact that there are Israeli Jews who are either non-Zionists or anti-Zionists who deplore what the Israeli government is doing, there are people on the right wing who are angry with the Israeli government about their reaction. Similarly, you know, to talk about Muslims as though they are all of one mind, as though they are all of one thought, is deeply reductionist and, frankly, deeply racist. And as a Jew, I find it deeply racist. You know, the fact that when I express the views that I have, that I was taught by my anti-racist ancestors who experienced the very worst of racism during the Holocaust, when, you know, that's the inspiration for my anti-racism. And some people say to me, oh, my God, well, then you can't be a proper Jew. I mean, who are these people to decide what is or isn't a proper Jew? I mean, that shows such a lack of understanding of religion, of culture, of everything else. And it's equally the case with Muslims. You know, who is to decide who is a Muslim and who is not, who represents Muslims, who does not? And also, it's very important to realize that not even all Palestinians are Muslims, for goodness sake. There are many Christian Palestinians and Palestinians of no faith. And these are all complex communities, and to try and reduce it to this sort of clash of civilizations, as one particular theory had it, is just a way for incredibly stupid, often racist people to try and understand what are quite nuanced issues. And the reality is we shouldn't lose sight in these issues of the fact is you can be on the side of human rights and international rule of law for everybody, and that includes Israel, it includes Russia, it includes Ukraine, it includes the Palestinians, or you can think that only certain people should have to stick to the international rule of law when it suits us in the West. And then we have to accept that there is no international rule of law and the world is chaos and anarchy. You can't have it both ways. So I think all of these debates, when you try and reduce them to this sort of black, white, good, bad, become an absolute nonsense. And unfortunately, that's what our politicians and our media try and do to us. Because if we actually applied our minds to what is going on in the world, in our names, often using our tax pounds, because some of the weapons that are being used to kill Palestinians at the moment are very, very, very heavily subsidized by our tax pounds through British defense companies like BAE Systems and others. And, you know, they want us to not think about these issues, to accept the nonsense that they sprout and that their apologists in the media write about and broadcast about, so that we don't think about these issues. Because anybody who has an iota of humanity will look at what is going on in Palestine at the moment and say, this has to stop, and it has to stop now. And I'm really glad to see that if you look at opinion polls, the vast majority of British people actually think that way. So I believe that our politicians and our media are completely out of touch with what ordinary Britons think. And that's why we need to use alternative media to actually get the real news and to get the sort of nuanced position of what is going on in the world, particularly at the moment in Israel and Palestine.
Well, that's a pretty good summary of everything that we've been discussing over the last hour or so. I think it is significant that 75% of British people, according to opinion polls, want an immediate ceasefire. It puts the political leadership in Britain on the spot. I see that Ed Davey has called for a ceasefire, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, but Keir Starmer can't bring himself to do that yet. Rishi Sunak has already made his position clear, because the Americans and the Israelis have told the British what the line is. We're not going to have a ceasefire here. But the rest of the world demands a ceasefire, and I think there will be a ceasefire, and Keir Starmer is going to look, he's going to find it hard to live this down. Apparently, you know, the opinion polls are showing that Muslim communities who overwhelmingly vote Labour in Britain are absolutely alienated from Starmer's position. And of course, they've got Jeremy Corbyn standing on at the demonstrations in London about what's going on, completely contradicting his position.
Well, look, behind the scenes, this has been going on for over a week with Starmer. They're saying that you should call for a ceasefire. Now the Scottish Labour leader and the Mayor of London have joined the calls publicly.
Yep.
They're coming out in public saying, look, Starmer's got to call for a ceasefire. Why is he not calling for a ceasefire? Well, the answer is he's part of the Israel lobby.
Well, I think he's still going to be Prime Minister. And if he was Prime Minister when all of this had kicked off, he would be making the wrong decisions. But it's probably not going to make that much difference, because a lot of the Muslim voters haven't really got any other choice on the first past the post. They'll have to vote Labour or they'll stay at home. But it's a very poor indication. The whole new Labour project was wrecked on the iceberg of Iraq. And we could have carried on having, middle of the road Labour governments if Tony Blair hadn't taken us to war in Iraq, which turned out to be a disaster to keep the Americans happy.
Well, okay. So that interview, the longer interview with Andrew Feinstein, will be up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk, where he really does lay into Keir Starmer, particularly for failing to call for a ceasefire, and talks about some of the influences there are behind the scenes on him not to do that. But let's wind up with some things a little bit more humorous. And this is, I'm not sure who it is, but they're condemning, talking about, if you're going to condemn Hamas, you may change your mind.
They want everyone to condemn Hamas. If someone asked me to condemn Hamas, I would say, what's the rush? Let's let history decide. You condemned Nat Turner until you didn't. You condemned Toussaint Louverture until you didn't. You condemned Nelson Mandela and the ANC until you didn't, until he was a hero. You condemned Mahatma Gandhi until you didn't. You condemned Yasser Arafat and the PLO until you gave Yasser Arafat Nobel Peace Prize. Let's just wait and see because you might change your mind on this one too.
It's good to see people actually bring a little bit of humor out of this, even if it's a bit dark humor.
I'm going to take the safe route. Take the safe route. Okay, now bomb the safe route. Bombing safe route. Tell them to go to the refugee center. Attention, Palestinians. Go to the refugee center. Now bomb the refugee center. Bombing refugee center. Oh, what? Looks like some of them are getting into ambulances. Bomb the ambulances. Copy. They're on their way to the hospital. Bomb the hospital. Bombing hospital. Okay, now tell them there's an escape route south to Egypt. Attention, Palestinians. Head south to Egypt. Okay, now bomb the escape route. Figured that. And again. Already on it. And again. What are we going to tell the press? Beheaded babies.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's a sad that there isn't more of this satire around, actually, I think, because it's nice to see people, Martin, isn't it, bursting the bubble of the lies, and there are a tremendous amount of lies out there, like those lies about the beheaded babies.
Well, that's right. And I think the point you made at the beginning is, you know, Hamas, as I said earlier, Hamas are the elected government of Palestine. They just are. We had an elected government in World War II, and that elected government, in its wisdom, decided to bomb Dresden and Hamburg and all these other places. But nobody went to war crimes trials because it was the elected government and it was a justifiable, in their eyes, I don't think the bombing of Dresden was justified, but there you are. Nobody's going to go to court about it because we won. And Hamas are being very ruthless with the lives of their own people. But on the other hand, I think that their calculation is we've got nothing to lose here. And the Israelis have got a lot to lose. And that it doesn't matter how enraged they get, they can't win because they're bringing a coalition of forces against them, which will end their state. And they need to grasp that. If they don't calm down and listen to advice, they're going to lose their state. And they'll only have themselves to blame when that happens.
I've said this before, Martin. Maybe what they're doing is just mowing the lawn. This is an elaborate, scare tactic to get the world all worried. Everyone's worried about this might turn into a third world war. They've got no intention of that happening. All they're really doing is just mowing the lawn, as the Israelis do every few years.
Yeah, but they didn't initiate this business.
Well, I thought you said that there was an influence of the Mossad and Israeli money in Hamas anyway.
Yes, well, it may be that Hamas were allowed to do it. It's let it happen on purpose. But they can't. Particularly in this kind of warfare, nobody can predict the outcomes. I mean, the West thought that they were going to win the war in Ukraine. But they haven't.
Well, I don't know that they did. I mean, a lot of these wars don't seem to be embarked on whether or not you're going to win or not. The whole point is to disrupt the enemy in one way or another, and you run along home. And also, of course, a lot of it is just motivated by spending on arms.
Well, that's all true, Tony, but ultimately, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. And we will see going forward, if we're around, who wins and who loses from this. The West is losing its control of the international system, which it's had since 1945. They created the State of Israel. They created the IMF. They created the World Bank. They invaded Vietnam. They invaded Iraq. They overthrew the government of Chile. They've done all of these things, but those days are coming to an end because you've now got a completely different configuration of economic forces in the world. The Chinese Communist Party banks are the biggest banks on the planet.
But in a way, that clip we heard from Amir Whiteman on RT says it all. It says to me that actually there is the West is trying to take out Russia. That's what a lot of this is about, that actually the Russian interests in Syria, etc., are all just part of the same big game.
Yes, and he said, and Ukraine is going to win. You remember, he said that as part of his rant. But Ukraine is losing. They've lost 500,000 soldiers in 6 months. They're not going to win anymore. The Israeli army is 300,000 strong. Most of them are conscripts, or rather they've done their national service and now they've been called up. But how long do you think an army of conscripts is going to last?
It's almost like the Israelis are a kind of doomsday cult. I mean, they are nuclear armed after all.
Well, that's right. And of course, those nuclear weapons, as Martin von Krefeld, the great philosopher of Israel, pointed out, they're there to attack us with. They're not for anybody else. Yeah, they're there to threaten the West if we start to prevent them from doing what they want to do.
Anyway, we're going to finish up.
They're dangerously out of control, and they're not being, you know, the tail is wagging the dog here.
We're going to finish up this week with, thanks very much, Martin. We're going to finish off, though, with this week and give the final word to Queen Rania of Jordan, who, and I'll put a full version of her speech up on an interview up on this week. .org.uk on our show page later, as with all the other longer interviews of all the other ones we've done, including the one with Peter Blakeney, was it? The copper. And he's a very interesting take on the demise of policing in Britain, which is not just about money. It's about whether or not the police are risk averse and how the whole institution is being steered. But anyway, let's leave the final word for Queen Rania of Jordan.
Jordan has made his position very clear. We condemn the killing of any civilian, whether Palestinian or Israeli. That is Jordan's ethical and moral position. And it's also the position of Islam. Islam condemns the killing of civilians. As my husband mentioned recently, the Pact of Omar, which was issued on the gates of Jerusalem 15 centuries ago, that's 1,000 years before the Geneva Conventions, orders Muslims not to hurt not to kill a woman, child, or elderly person. And not to destroy a tree or hurt a priest. And so this is what we believe are the rules of engagement at time of war. But they need to apply to everybody. So, yes, there was the shock and there is the condemnation. But why isn't there equal condemnation to what is happening now? I just want to emphasize that what happened on October, this conflict did not begin on October 7th, although it has been being portrayed as that. You know, most networks are covering the story under the title of Israel at War. But for many Palestinians on the other side of the separation wall, on the other side of the barbed wire, war has never left. This is a 75-year-old story, a story of overwhelming death and displacement to the Palestinian people. It is a story of an occupation under an apartheid regime that occupies land, that demolishes houses, confiscates land, military incursions, night raids. You know, the context of a nuclear-armed regional superpower that occupies, oppresses, and commits daily documented crimes against Palestinians is missing from the narrative.
Queen Rania?
You know, for too long, Palestinians' lives...
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I want to ask you a specific question because you're using a lot of words which clearly many in your, you know, in the Arab world have used, words like apartheid and the rest. But you know that you are going to come under a lot of criticism from Israel and its supporters. And I'm wondering whether you're coming out to speak.
But let me just emphasize that apartheid is a designation that was given not by Arabs, but by Israeli and international human rights organizations.
So that's Queen Rania of Jordan there, winding up our show for today. Final word, though, as always, to Patricia. An ode to Gaza continued. You are either with us or against us, is now Israel's only line. Speaking truth on Gaza, now considered a sacking crime. Antonio Guterres condemned terror on both sides. Measured words now seem in vain as death becomes the favoured prize. Bibi, meanwhile, plotting a new attack on Gaza. Threats, a ground invasion promises. It's clear that now all bets are off the bloodied table, the beginning of fresh hell. One may stop and wonder. Is this the devil's spell? No good will ever come of this. Perhaps this is evil's part, to fight until each life is lost and out of Gaza take its heart. Thanks again, Patricia. Time to sign off now. Thanks to Irish publican, Labour activist Martin Summers. Also to Mark Smullyan, who joined us there. And, of course, to Justin Thomas. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. And follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Also, thanks to the sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, and comment page, and our email address. Sorry, there was no time for a break this week, a musical break. You can subscribe also to my weekly email list, which is really a newsletter. It goes out on a Sunday night, and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us this show, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream next Friday. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
Masses, evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction, in the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning, death and hatred to mankind. Poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.
darkness world stops turning. Ashes where the body's burning. No more war pigs have the power. And as God has struck the hour, day of judgment, God is calling. On the knees, the war pigs crawling, begging mercies for the sins. Satan laughing spreads his wings. Oh!